Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
You're nobody till somebody kills you.
You're nobody.
And we end this podcast with a first of its kind. The auction house Sotheby's is offering collectors the chance to bid on pieces from the golden age of hip-hop. Maybe you want Teenage Love Letters by Tupac or the golden crown worn by the notorious B.I.G. for a photo shoot days before he was shot and killed. Here's Monica Lynch, former president of Tommy Boy Records, who helped put the event together, and Cassandra Hatton, vice president at Sotheby's in New York.
Yes, yes, y'all. Check it out, y'all. Yes, yes, y'all. Check it out.
We have clothing, artifacts, jewelry, letters, contemporary art, photography. Many people have a misconception that hip hop is just a musical genre, but it's really a cultural movement that includes music.
What I'd like the auction to tell is that the artistry of hip hop, which started in the early 70s, is tremendous. It's multifaceted. Hip hop has been with us for over 50 years now. Two of my favorites actually are the fantastic jackets that were owned by two of the members of JJ Fad, Baby D and MCJB. These are really iconic female pioneers from the West Coast.
It's like this, if you got the time to go head up with the double J FAD, then.
And their jackets are so amazing. One is a beautifully ornate, embellished denim jacket that has New York up and down the sleeves and the skyline on the back. And the second jacket, he has a beautiful pink satin jacket with embroidery that says Ruthless Records, which was Eazy-E's label. I'm down with the JJ Fad jacket. Wham, bam,
bam, and they're gone. I'm really excited about the experiences in this sale. One where bidders will have the opportunity to do a wine tasting with Big Daddy Kane. There's another where bidders get to have a lyric writing lesson and studio recording session with Rakim, the God MC. And then another where bidders will get the chance to go spend the day with Dapper Dan of Harlem, the legendary tailor of Harlem, and design a custom piece. And what I think is so fantastic about this is we have some living legends that are part of this auction.
I think that it's about art and it's about culture and wonderful artifacts. I think it's been very undervalued in terms of the art and auction marketplace. So I think it's a really great opportunity to shine a light on some people who are very, very deserving of attention from the global audience.
Monica Lynch, former president of Tommy Boy Records, and you also heard from Cassandra Hatton, vice president at Sotheby's in New York.
Billie Holiday, I sing your blues. Bet your life against me and I swear to God you're losing. Motherfuck the cops, we still singing for St. Louis. Motherfuck the cops, we still singing for St. Louis. Motherfuck the cops, we still singing for St. Louis.
Gwen Berry made it from childhood in Ferguson all the way to the Olympics. She competed 4 years ago in Rio in track and field. And 3 years later, she won a gold medal at the Pan Am Games. But on the podium, she raised her fist to protest racial injustice. And she's since paid a high price for that. She joins us today to discuss it. Gwen Berry, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me. How are you?
So, Gwen, your specialty is the hammer throw. What did you do at the Pan Am Games last summer to win that gold medal?
Well, you know, it was pretty tough because, you know, it was colder than what we had all expected. And, you know, usually for track and field, it's during the spring. Mm. So I had to, you know, grit and bear it, and I had to dig down deep and know that with my training and my technique that I could toss a good throw to win.
So when you had this championship win here, you get up there on the podium to get your medal. Had you been planning at that point to protest?
No, I was not planning to protest. I had no indication or any motivation to protest until I got on the podium and the national anthem played. And I knew that with me being self-taught and me going to a freedom school, I knew what the national anthem meant, and I knew that it wasn't for people like me. And I wasn't at peace with myself on the podium, so then I protested.
You mentioned the freedom school. Tell us what that is.
So a freedom school is just a school for African-Americans who are here that need to know more about themselves because, you know, Black history isn't truly taught authentically in schools and in colleges. So Black people created freedom schools. So you go there, you learn more details, you learn more people, and you just learn more about your culture and where you come from.
Hmm. So you learned enough there that when you heard that national anthem, it kind of evoked a feeling in you, and you went with it.
Yes. Absolutely.
So I couldn't help but think back to the 1968 games in Mexico City when track athletes Tommy Smith and John Carlos, they each raised a gloved fist on the podium. Was that on your mind when you raised your fist?
Definitely. I feel like as a kid, you know, you always see that image. My father, he always put that image in my head, and he always told me how significant it was. And every coach that I know and every track and field athlete that I know has that picture hanging up in their room.
Mm-hmm.
So I feel like that image was definitely resonated with me.
So how did you, so you had this moment, you raise your fist. When did you realize after this moment, hey, there's some people who are really unhappy about this?
I didn't realize it until the next day. I felt that what I did that day, I didn't harm anybody. It was peaceful. It's not like I disrespected anybody or anything. Mm-hmm. But once I got off the podium and, you know, I went to sleep that night, I woke up and the world had gone crazy.
How so? I mean, were people reaching out to you with thoughts on this or what kind of, how did it hit you?
Absolutely. I had a lot of people threatening me, a lot of people, you know, of course, telling me to go back to Africa and to leave the country and that I didn't deserve to, you know, wear the uniform. But the death threats were the most, the scariest things. I never knew that people could wish bad on you because you just didn't agree with a song or a flag.
When you say people were telling you to go back to Africa, just for the record here, I mean, you were born and raised in East St. Louis and then in Ferguson.
Absolutely.
This had nothing to do with your immediate background.
No, it did not at all.
And where were people finding you to give these threats?
On Instagram, on Twitter. Those are the most two frequent social media sites. And I do have my email address on those sites, so people were actually taking time to email me as well.
Wow. So how did you respond to that? Because that can be so hard when there's just such a tsunami of anger coming at you.
Yeah, it was quite overwhelming. What I did was, you know, I got off social media. I didn't reply. I didn't respond. A lot of people and a lot of friends, you know, they had my back. They replied and responded for me. But I just deleted my apps because I just didn't have time for the negativity.
So there was this wave of negativity that came from the public. And then you heard from the International Olympic Committee. How did you first hear from them? And how long after that incident did it happen?
So I heard from the IOC and the USOPC quite immediately. So the very next day. The very next day I had a meeting and they told me that I broke the rules and they asked me, did I acknowledge that I did break the rules. And then probably not even a week later, they handed down my probation.
When you say you broke the rules, what was the rule that they were saying you broke?
So the rule is Rule 50. And that's the rule that the IOC comes up with, that you are not allowed to display any type of racial, religious or political propaganda on the field of play.
And do you feel like that describes what you did there in raising your fist?
Absolutely not. I did not entice anyone. I did not do anything demeaning to anybody. And so I don't feel like my my protest was harmful. So I don't feel like it was as big of a deal as they tried to make it seem. I did something in my time on my stage, and a fist could not kill anybody where I was, you know, where I was raising it. I was harming no one.
You say you were hit with a 12-month probation. What does that mean for an Olympic athlete?
Oh, for an Olympic athlete, a 12-month probation means that you are not allowed to make the same mistake twice. So in that 12 months, I was not allowed to speak out on these issues that I, you know, believed in. I was not allowed to demean the USA in any type of way. So I was not allowed to, like, talk about the president or anything like that. And I also was not allowed to make any type of hand gesture on the field of play or on the podium, or else I would be in further trouble.
Okay. So that was more than a year ago. I imagine that timing is not a coincidence. You did keep quiet for that 12 months.
Here and there, yes. I feel like I did speak out on about it, but because there was no competitions, I could not, you know, I couldn't do anything further.
Okay, that makes sense. So having that probation and having just all this hate come your way, did that end up having any financial repercussions for you?
Oh, absolutely. I basically almost lost my career if it wasn't for my mentor and my family supporting me. I could have been out of the sport. I lost about 80% of my income.
And how so? For those of us who aren't Olympic athletes, we're never sure about how the financial underpinnings of this work. Is this in terms of sponsorships?
Yes. So everything for Olympic athletes is always based on sponsorships, because the IOC and every national governing body under that, it's not really a business to where they pay us a wage or they pay us a salary for our athletic performances. So Olympic athletes have to find sponsors to help them go reach the pinnacle of meeting the games or getting on the podium. So when those sponsors pull out or they defund you, then that's detrimental to your career.
And these sponsors, are they corporations or they're individuals?
It can be both. It's foundations, corporations, individuals. It's free game.
So you lost, you said, 80% of those. Is that right?
Yes.
So how did you even pay your bills? I mean, that sounds like a huge financial hit right there.
Yeah, so luckily, you know, I'm good at saving money. That's one thing. You know, my family has always taught me how to save money and to, you know, keep money aside for the rainy day. And like I said, my mentors, my friends, my living situations, like, they've helped me with that tremendously.
That's great. Do you expect those sponsorships to come back now that that year of probation is over?
I doubt it. I don't know.
I mean, you might have taken a permanent hit here.
Yeah, definitely. I was kind of blackballed. Yeah, of course.
And how do you feel about that?
I feel like I'm kind of disgusted. I feel like because the hypocrisy is unreal, right? So I did this at a time where, you know, these movements were not trending. These movements were only seen as bad because, you know, everyone saw what the NFL did to Kaepernick. So everyone was scared to say anything or do anything.
Mm-hmm.
So when I did it, it was the same. I got the same response, probably even worse, because I can't sue, you know, the IOC or anything for me losing money. Because it's not a business.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, for me, everything was just, it was horrible for me. It was really horrible. And I can't believe now that the times have changed and, you know, everyone's trying to be on the right side of history.
Yeah, it feels like your timing was just terrible. But in some ways, it was maybe good. You were ahead of this curve. You didn't wait until it became trendy to do. You made your move and you stood firm. But now you're paying a price that maybe a lot of other athletes who are speaking out aren't having to pay.
Yeah, absolutely. But I feel like through my sacrifice, it's making other athletes bold enough and brave enough to say something.
More than 66,000 people have died from COVID-19 in Mexico. Health officials there say that ailments like diabetes, hypertension, and obesity make the virus especially deadly. Junk food and sugary drinks can dominate many Mexican diets, and as James Frederick reports, the pandemic has led to a new urgency to try to change that.
Picture this. You're 17, you walk into your local corner store, grab some Cheetos, maybe a Coke. But soon, in two Mexican states, here's the answer you'll get.
Joven, disculpe, pero este producto no se lo puedo vender.
Sorry, I can't sell you that stuff without a parent, just like alcohol and cigarettes. Under new laws in Oaxaca and Tabasco states, no one under 18 will be able to buy junk food or sugary drinks. Lawmaker Magali Lopez spearheaded the ban with a bill she got through the Oaxaca State Congress. It's awaiting the governor's signature. She says, I know it sounds drastic, but it was necessary to take action now. Oaxaca is Mexico's epicenter of childhood obesity, and Mexico ranks number one for obesity in the world. At least a dozen other states have similar bans in the works, but there's pushback from people like Cuauhtémoc Rivera, the president of a group that lobbies on behalf of small businesses. He says formal businesses will just move to street vendors who will sell this stuff to kids with little oversight. And Rivera says the pandemic has already crushed thousands of small businesses. Restrictions on chips and soda, shops' best-selling products, will be devastating. And not just for shop owners. He acknowledges Mexicans lack the means to buy healthier food, so they fill their stomachs with cheap calories. Things like potato chips, white breads, and sugary drinks. That's one point where Rivera is in agreement with supporters of the new laws. Mexicans eat badly because they're short on money, time, and healthy options. But that's not the whole picture, says Ana Larrañaga, who lobbies for health-oriented public policy.
For many years, the government allowed self-regulation from the industry or very weak nutrition standards.
She notes that a former president, Vicente Fox, once served as CEO of Coca-Cola Mexico. Later, Coca-Cola tried to buy goodwill with a school fitness program, now widely seen as a failure. Things began to change in 2014 when the government imposed a tax on sugary drinks. And last year, a new federal law passed. Starting in October, giant font warning labels will be slapped on the front of food packages. Things like excess sodium, excess trans fats. The new law will also ban advertising unhealthy foods to children. The main Coca-Cola distributor here has filed a legal challenge. I asked kids in Mexico City how they'd feel if their state also banned junk food sales to minors. 16-year-old Wendy Treviño was surprisingly typical. Yeah, I'd be frustrated at first if I couldn't buy a Coke, she says. But I'd adapt and maybe I'd go for a piece of fruit instead. I reached 17-year-old Daniela Santiago in Natividad, a small town in the highlands of Oaxaca, the state that first passed the ban. She explains how when new stores appeared in town selling processed foods, it was supposedly a sign of progress. But to counter the health impact, an NGO is now giving them nutrition courses. That's how Daniela learned about diabetes, hypertension, and all the ailments associated with a poor diet. Now, Daniela says she's happy to stick to the traditional meals her family prepares at home. What Oaxacans ate before junk food and sodas sparked the obesity epidemic that's now proving so deadly. For NPR News, I'm James Frederick in Mexico City.
Do you mind if we stay here a while, or must you go home?
There are no musts in my life. I'm free, white, and 21.
You're lucky.
As COVID outbreaks are popping up at colleges, campuses are cracking down on students violating COVID prevention rules. And colleges face another threat, legal challenges from the students they're punishing. NPR's Tobias Smith reports.
Some of the misconduct is brazen, like the hundreds of Syracuse University students who risked everyone's safety and everyone's semester by partying like it's not 2020. 23 students at that party were kicked out, and the same thing's happening to students in smaller, more chill gatherings. For example, 11 Northeastern University students who were caught hanging out together in one room, violating bans on crowded gatherings and on guests in student rooms.
I was just like, come on. It was really irresponsible and selfish.
Many on campus, like junior Avery Collard, say those students who were all kicked out for the semester had it coming.
There's very specific rules that say you can't do that. So, you know, you're adults. help. I know it's hard, but, like, act like it.
But others on campus, like junior Raya Bibby, take issue with the university, too, for not only booting the offenders off campus, but also refusing to refund their tuition.
I think there are other ways to send a message than to take $36,000 away from incoming students. I also think it's important that in your freshman year, like, a bit of grace can be given.
This is just a spiteful, gratuitous, grossly disproportionate penalty.
Attorney Brett Joshby appealed the suspension for two of the students who he says were just watching a basketball game with masks on. Northeastern refused to budge on the suspensions, but today told students that part of the money they lost can be applied to future tuition. Officials declined to comment beyond their initial statement that the students were repeatedly warned of the rules and the consequences. It's hardly the only school whose tough disciplinary actions are under scrutiny. Attorneys say their phones haven't stopped ringing.
This has gone from a few cases here and there to a near epidemic.
Attorney Andrew Miltenberg has long represented students accused of sexual assault, arguing that those alleged sexual predators were victims of a rush to judgment. Schools, he says, are now doing the same thing to alleged super spreaders.
They're not allowing any discussion, any mitigating circumstances. People are being summarily suspended, and there is no due process.
Schools are taking a suspend first, expel first, ask questions later stance.
Will Creeley with the Foundation for Individual Rights in Education, a civil rights group, says he's also getting multiple calls a day.
We wonder if in a desire to continue collecting full tuition that maybe students have been set up to be the fall people here and they're being held to basically an impossible standard.
But schools insist students do get due process. It just sometimes comes after the fact. Kenneth Elmore is dean of students at Boston University, where multiple suspensions are being reviewed.
These are different times, and we've got to make some emergency decisions based upon the facts available so that we can make sure that other people aren't at risk.
But when investigations are done after the fact, Miltenberg says the damage is often already done to students and their reputations, especially in cases of what he calls more questionable violations. For example, he represents one student who walked into his dorm's bathroom not realizing he was the seventh guy there and he was putting the bathroom space one man over capacity. It was an accident, Miltenberg says. Should students be expected to peek under the stalls and count feet?
Students are truly bewildered. Can you take a shower? Can you use the toilet? It's all very vague.
I understand this is hard stuff.
BU's Dean Elmore concedes that schools are still figuring things out as they go. Normally, he says, he's more the moral suasion type than the drop the hammer kind of guy, but these are not normal times.
I mean, personally, this is really difficult for me, and I know it sounds weird coming from the person who is the apparent executioner, but we gotta do it. And it's a way to say, no, we are serious about this.
It's a steep learning curve for both administrators and students, he says, and the stakes are high either way, if schools get it wrong or if students do. Tovia Smith, NPR News, Boston.
White supremacy is the sickness.
The majority of children dying from COVID-19 are children of color. That's according to a new report from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention that reveals dramatic disparities in the illness among children. NPR's Patty Namond reports.
Researchers found more than 390,000 cases and 121 deaths among young people under 21 years old between February and July of this year. 78% of the children who died were Black, Hispanic, or Native American. Pediatric infectious disease specialist Tina Tan with the Robert H. Lurie Children's Hospital of Chicago.
This really is something that we've known since children have started to get fairly sick with COVID.
And while most children have mild symptoms, some don't. Tan says the staggering disparity between ethnic minorities and whites reflects disproportionate medical conditions that puts both adults and children of color at greater risk of complications from coronavirus, things like asthma, obesity, and heart conditions. 3/4 of the children who died had underlying conditions. Most were between 10 and 20 years old. The report also points to social disparities that puts communities of color at greater risk.
households that are very crowded. Parents are generally essential workers that usually have to take public transportation to work, so they're exposed more frequently to COVID than other individuals.
And access to health care can be difficult, all adding up to greater vulnerability for children of color.
It's just really important that this is on people's radar.
Parents shouldn't panic, says Tan, but they should be vigilant with their children about wearing masks, physical distancing, and lots of hand washing, especially if their child is attending in-person school. Infectious disease specialist Preeti Malani with the University of Michigan says the big takeaway from the study is this.
If your child is sick and you don't feel like they're doing well, is to not wait and to make sure that they are seen
by a doctor or at the hospital.
A child, especially with something like this, which is a respiratory infection, could go from having something that's very mild to becoming quite ill quickly.
CDC officials say children and teens exposed to COVID-19 should be closely monitored for complications, even though symptoms associated with the infection are more mild in children compared with adults. Patty Namond, NPR News.
White supremacy is the sickness.
When people talk about structural racism, they often point to redlining. That was a practice that banks used for decades to avoid lending money to the residents of black and immigrant neighborhoods. Though redlining was outlawed in 1968, a new nationwide study shows it continues to have an effect on the health of neighborhoods and the people who live there. NPR's Maria Godoy reports.
Tori Edmonds has lived in the same house in the east end of Churchill, in a largely African-American section of Richmond, Virginia, since the 1950s.
I actually came home from the hospital into this house.
Edmonds says when she was a little girl, the neighborhood was a place of tidy homes with rose bushes and fruit trees, and residents had ready access to local businesses.
You know, we had a bowling alley, a movie theater, several grocery stores.
Eventually, her parents tried to get a loan so they could get new windows for the house. They were rejected.
And for a long time, the house was deteriorating. And that's what you see with a lot of the homes in the community. If the bank's not loaning, then things deteriorate.
Researchers say this is a classic example of what happened to communities across the U.S. that were once subject to a discriminatory lending policy called redlining. The practice dates back to the 1930s, when the federal government raided neighborhoods to help mortgage lenders decide which areas of cities were risky. Those with African Americans and immigrants were almost always considered to be the highest risk, and they were marked in red on maps, hence redlining. Jason Richardson is research director with the National Community Reinvestment Coalition. They recently released a study conducted with the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee and the University of Richmond. It analyzed historic redlining maps from communities across the U.S. and compared them with health outcomes in those areas today. What they found was a disturbing pattern.
When banks and other actors are discouraged from lending in a community, you see a very kind of predictable arc of that community, right?
A lack of investment meant houses fell into disrepair. That led to health hazards like mold and lead paint. Redlined neighborhoods were more likely to be near industrial sites, which meant more exposure to pollution. And they were less likely to have parks and grocery stores, which meant less access to healthy food and places to exercise. Tori Edmonds saw this play out in her Richmond neighborhood. By the 1970s, she says many homes had become rentals. Local stores disappeared.
And then when they did come back, they were like those 40-ounce stores, those corner stores that sold a lot of cheap beer and wine, no real food.
It wasn't just this neighborhood. It's also true in neighborhoods in Chicago, Milwaukee, Miami. Jason Richardson says that in the 142 urban areas they studied, people who live in neighborhoods today that were historically redlined have shorter lifespans on average. They also have higher rates of diabetes, obesity, hypertension, kidney disease, asthma, stroke, many of which are risk factors for more severe cases of COVID-19.
When I stop and think about it, I'm kind of shocked by the lingering impact of these policies.
But the study's conclusions come as no surprise to Tori Edmonds.
Trust me, I know.
Edmonds works for Virginia Commonwealth University promoting community health, and she knows that the average life expectancy in the mostly black community where she lives is just 67 years. That's 22 years less than in a well-off white community a few miles away. a community that got the highest rating on those government redlining maps back in the 1930s.
We talk about it, we research it, and my question is, now that we know and we're very clear about what's happening, what do we do about it?
Maria Godoy, NPR News.
For all individuals suffering with mental health issues, there's the danger of stigma, of getting called crazy or psycho, or not being treated with compassion in one way or another. When you're Black and have a mental illness, that stigma can more frequently turn deadly. That was the case, of course, with Daniel Prude, the 41-year-old man who was killed by the police in Rochester, New York. The medical examiner ruled it a homicide. His brother had called the police because Daniel had left the house and he was worried for his brother's safety because he was in the midst of a mental health crisis. Here is Joe Prude, Daniel's brother, recalling that night in March.
For a person like that, that you love so much to just disappear and thin out, it's like, wow, how did I lose sight of him that quick when I had my whole eye on him the whole time? And in the process, like, of me trying to figure out which way he went, I immediately got on the phone with 911. This is what the outcome. I called him for to lynch my brother. I didn't call him to come help my brother die. I called him to come help me get my brother some help.
Now, since that story came out last month, protesters have been out in Rochester demanding a change in police leadership and also that the police stop responding to calls relating to mental health. We've talked about that aspect of the defund the police or police reform movement before, and we'll touch on it again during this segment. But today we wanted to focus on looking at the compounding forces of having a mental illness and being Black, of the fear and anxiety that surrounds those forces, especially when thinking about how society sees you and interactions with the police. I'll invite your calls in a minute, but first let me introduce my guest. Dr. Ashwin Vasan is an epidemiologist and professor at Columbia and the CEO of Fountain House, one of the world's oldest and largest community-based mental health and public health charities, and Christina Sparrow. She's a mental health advocate and Fountain House member. In her day job, she works as a CPA. Dr. Vasan, welcome back to WNYC. And Christina, welcome. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
And
thank you.
Dr. Vasan, if people have heard you on the show previously, you've been here several times recently, they may think of you as a COVID expert, but you also work extensively on issues related to mental health. I'll remind everybody, not just physical health. We're finally doing a segment on your day job. So as a doctor, what should have happened that March night with Daniel Prude?
Yeah, thanks, Brian. And, you know, I think part of what, because I wear these two hats, I think, you know, one of my goals is to really push forward a conversation where we talk about health holistically, where mental health and physical health are treated the same and really thought of as requiring health responses. And what we saw with Daniel Prude and with just so many other victims of these tragedies is that we don't have systematic health responses in the community for mental health crises. And instead, we deploy solutions that emphasize control, punishment, and unfortunately, law enforcement. And, you know, we wouldn't do that for a heart attack. We wouldn't do that for a diabetic emergency. But for some reason, and, you know, I think the reasons are clear, we stigmatize and discriminate against mental illness and people living with mental illness in such a way that we end up criminalizing it and have historically criminalized it for so long. And so what should have happened on that day with Daniel, with Mr. Prude and his family was, you know, his brother did all the right things. He called for help. There are no real options for people who need help for their family members and loved ones in crises other than 911 in most cases. And so what we needed, and what so many people need is a better matching of the problem and the solution. You know, when a house is on fire, you don't call the cops, you call the fire department. When someone is having a health emergency, you call a paramedic, an EMS worker, not the police. But what is happening, what happened with Daniel was a health crisis. Something was happening with him biologically, neurologically, cognitively, that was manifesting in his behavior not being it was outside of the range of normal for him. And, you know, at that moment, I can imagine Mr. Prude was one of the least aware and most frightened parties in that situation. And so the presence of a police officer as his first point of contact, you know, in many cases is escalating and not de-escalating. And so what should have happened is that his first point of contact should have been a mental health professional, ideally working with a peer, someone who lives with the mental health condition, who are skilled and trained and expert and go through years of training to understand how to connect with, engage, relate to, de-escalate, and respond nonviolently to people in mental health crises. And the good news is that we have models all around the country that work and that have good results on how to do this. But unfortunately, those are just islands of excellence instead of standard practice, and we have to change that.
And before we bring in Christina, I think we should mention that your organization, Fountain House, has a direct link to this issue with member Deborah Danner sadly being killed in a police encounter during a mental health crisis in 2016. That was a, quote, news story at the time. Can you remind us of what happened with Deborah Danner?
Yeah, absolutely. Deborah was a member of Fountain House before my time, but someone who, you know, had a long history with our organization and was just really a fantastic member of our community, a fantastic peer, a fantastic supporter, and helped so many others who were trying to recover and live with mental illness, you know, connect up with our community and begin their journey of recovery. She was a 66-year-old woman with schizophrenia, and she was undergoing a mental health crisis. A neighbor called for what they thought was a wellness check, a welfare check, and she was in her apartment having an active mental health crisis and was the victim of a police shooting in her own apartment. And, you know, that was a entirely preventable tragedy. In addition, Deborah was a writer, and tragically, she wrote openly and publicly predicting her own death at the hands of police. And so, yeah, this is very personal to us at Fountain House. It's very personal to our community. It's very personal to everyone at the, you know, 14 projects around New York City that we support and the others in 37 states around the country that we support. It's personal to everyone involved who really fundamentally believes that people living with mental illness don't belong in institutions. They don't belong behind bars. They don't belong in our emergency rooms and in our hospitals. They need supportive infrastructure and communities where they live to help them on their journey to recovery and reintegration.
Was there a racial component, in your opinion, in the Deborah Danner case? And did that case, since it did generate at least some publicity, certainly not like what's happening with Daniel Prude and some of the other things that have gone on this year, but some, did it result in any systemic reform in the NYPD?
Well, I'd be remiss if I didn't highlight the underlying racism here, the structural racism, both in our response to people with mental illness as well as in policing. Just to give you some statistics, you know, Black Americans, only one out of three Black Americans can actually receive mental health care when they need it. Not only do we lack providers who work in low-income communities, and we lack psychiatrists to accept Medicaid, we have an issue where we don't have enough culturally competent providers. So there aren't enough Black and brown psychiatrists. And we know through a whole bunch of evidence that establishing a therapeutic relationship for mental health requires some ability to connect up with the provider and their lived experience as well, so that you feel like the person listening to you comes from a similar place and can understand your cultural and specific background. And so we have this situation where Black and brown Americans, particularly Black Americans, lack access to care. The quality of care they receive is lower because of the lack of cultural competency. And historically, we have overdiagnosed more serious forms of mental illness in Black Americans versus white Americans. For example, Black Americans are more likely to be diagnosed with schizophrenia and bipolar disorder instead of garden variety depression and anxiety, which is a much more common diagnosis in white communities and non-Black communities. And so with that, there's an inherent racism in the way we deliver mental health care and access to mental health care and quality of mental health care. Add to that the fact that in the absence of mental health solutions and health care solutions, we choose to criminalize it and to put on this notion of violence and safety predominantly for Black Americans with mental health crises, which is very much in line with what we're seeing with policing overall and racial injustice in policing overall. And you have this really toxic intersection of these two systems failures, which both are driven by structural racism. And so, yes, I think that's a long answer, but the short answer is there must have been. There must have been. That isn't to say that the officers in the case and the specific decisions made at the time were racist. It's that our systems and our drivers for why there are these interactions and why these interactions play out the way they do are certainly driven by structural racism. Just to give you a data point, mm-hmm. there have been 16 victims over the last 5 years of police shootings or police violence with mental illness in New York City alone. 14 of those 16 were Black or people of color. And so we have a systematic response to mental illness that is failing. We have a systematic response to policing of Black communities and brown communities that is failing. And this is the intersection of those two things.
Medical apartheid, the dark history of medical experimentation on Black Americans from colonial times to the present.
A whistleblower complaint filed this week alleges that immigrant detainees at a privately operated detention facility in Georgia were subjected to hysterectomies at an alarmingly high rate. The complaint was filed by the human rights group Project South and alleges that these procedures were done without informed consent from the women. Jose Olivares, an associate producer on The Takeaway for WNYC, co-authored this story for The Intercept, and he joins us now. Welcome.
Thanks so much for having me.
So how many women were actually affected by this, according to your reporting? Can you describe what exactly happened to them?
Sure. So the details are still a little bit unclear, but according to one woman that we spoke with, estimated that as many as 20 others were recommended for an operation by this gynecologist. And according to an interview that we conducted with the whistleblower, Don Wooten, she estimated that more than 20 women had undergone hysterectomies in the last 6 years. Now, what we've also found out today is that Representative Jayapal from Washington State mm-hmm. has spoken with a number of attorneys who have disclosed to her that at least 17 immigrant women in Irwin were subject to these hysterectomies by a gynecologist while in the custody of Immigration and Customs Enforcement.
And you had a chance to speak with at least one of the gynecologists who allegedly performed hysterectomies, as well as other procedures and exams without informed consent. What was this gynecologist's explanation for all of this?
So the whistleblower complaints did not name or identify the gynecologist in question, but we spoke with advocates and a former detention employee and an immigrant themselves who disclosed the identity and pointed us in the direction of who this gynecologist was. And when I spoke with this doctor, they vehemently denied the allegations. They said that they only performed a couple of hysterectomies in the past couple of years, that these allegations were ruining their practice. However, they did note that if this doctor makes a diagnosis and needs to perform a certain procedure, they have to get approval and permission from the facility to carry out this procedure. My colleague John Washington and myself, when we reached out to ICE, they vehemently denied the allegations.
Well, I understand that this whistleblower complaint contains other disturbing allegations that haven't been reported on as much as these alleged hysterectomies. Can you talk about those other allegations?
Absolutely. I think there was a lot of shocking information that this whistleblower put forward regarding the failure by management and by facility staff to protect detainees and staff from contracting COVID. Now, when this whistleblower began speaking up internally, they ended up demoting her. She sees that as it being retaliation for speaking out internally. Mm-hmm. But some of the things that management was doing is they were not necessarily adhering to the CDC guidelines of social distancing. They did not provide masks to detainees in the facility. In fact, the detainees had to make their own masks out of bed sheets and clothing while in the facility, and they weren't able to access masks until a local church group ended up donating them to the facility.
Well, as you say, this has gotten the attention of lawmakers. What do you expect to be happening next on this story?
Well, because this story is so explosive and because these allegations are so big, advocates are really pushing for an investigation into whether the hysterectomies have taken place at such a high rate, but also they're calling for an investigation into the treatment of detainees and staff amid the COVID-19 pandemic. When we reached out to ICE and to the private prison company LaSalle Corrections, they refused to speak with us or give us a statement saying that they could not comment because the Office of Inspector General under the Department of Homeland Security was already investigating the whistleblower claims. So it's really difficult to tell if the Office of Inspector General is indeed investigating these allegations and what step of the process they are.
That is Jose Olivares from member station WNYC. He co-authored this report for The Intercept alongside John Washington. Thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you so much. Really appreciate it.
Inside the inside of Lockdown America. When one considers the social implications of COVID-19's rampage throughout America, one must recognize that its greatest impact was upon perhaps 80% of America, those who were in what is now called lockdown, unable to leave their homes except to shop for food or, if an essential worker, to work. Millions of Americans had an intimate opportunity to experience lockdown, which for singles or some elders was a strange form of solitary confinement. For many people in America's prisons, general population, also known as mainline, became close to solitary confinement. For prisoners, jobs, education, recreation, and gyms became shuttered areas, off limits to people deeply habituated to daily or regular access to such activities. As for solitary confinement, it was this in large strokes. But here was solitary with a difference. The difference? This kind of solitary had no release date, therefore, many prisoners are still in this form of solitary with no cutoff date to date. For how long would COVID-19 reign over the land? No one knows. The idea that some prison official will, anytime soon, yell all clear is laughable. The nation may see 200,000 deaths in the next few weeks, and perhaps over 6 million cases. So, the coronavirus is alive and well in America and in the nation's prisons. When COVID-19 first struck, activists believed it heralded a time of mass releases to rival mass incarceration. It seems they underestimated the state's addiction to prisons as a political staple, not to mention an economic mainstay. What this really means, however, is that many prisons have become more than solitary confinement units. They have become, in the time of COVID, new death rows. So the question is not how many folks will get sick, but how many will die. The fear, anxiety, and distress is off the charts. For Prison Radio, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
This guy body slammed this this 16-year-old black girl in class. I mean, she would not give up her phone, which was wrong, and then she wouldn't leave the room, which is wrong. But he compounded it by, I think, this is just horrendous to treat a child like this, a teenager. But I also have sympathy for people in authority because I think parents just let kids do anything nowadays, so they never listen to authority.
Some school districts have cut ties with police departments following recent police killings of black men and women. In Florida, activists are demanding districts there do the same, but a state law enacted after the shooting at a high school in Parkland 2 years ago requires that a police officer or armed guard be stationed at every public school. Jessica Bakeman from member station WLRN in Miami reports.
Right after 17 people were shot and killed at Marjory Stoneman Douglas High School, the Broward County District posted a lot more police and security guards on campuses. The change didn't go unnoticed by many black students who say cops in schools make them feel less safe.
And I remember walking off the bus and seeing these three men gathered together with like AR-15s in their hands.
Olivia is 17 and was a freshman at another high school in Broward County the year of the shooting.
I looked over and he looked right at me, and the way he stared at me was terrifying. Like, he looked like I was a threat. I didn't feel like a person anymore. Like, all he was seeing was my skin.
Olivia and her friend Joy have been harassed and threatened on social media after participating in Black Lives Matter protests. So they asked us not to include their last names. Joy is also 17 and a high school senior.
There's a racial bias in the police system, so why would we want that in our schools as well?
Since a white police officer killed George Floyd in Minneapolis and protesters filled the streets in historic uprisings, major school districts throughout the country have voted to get police out of schools. Minneapolis and St. Paul, San Francisco, Oakland, Seattle, Portland, Denver, some schools in Chicago. In South Florida, student activists want the same thing to happen here. This is a student-led protest in Broward County back in June that Olivia and Joy attended.
Defund the police!
Defund the police!
But they face what could be an insurmountable challenge, the aftermath of Parkland. Florida's new law requiring a cop or armed guard on every campus was enacted shortly after the horrific school shooting 2.5 years ago. The number of police in schools statewide nearly doubled because of it. In Broward County, the people in charge of the school district and campus police are black. The school superintendent referred our questions to the sheriff.
As a black man, I live the injustices.
Sheriff Gregory Toney recently allocated $1 million of the department's budget toward racial equity and implicit bias training for deputies.
I was George Floyd. At 16, I got slammed against the ground and had a knee on my neck in Philadelphia by a bunch of overly aggressive and abusive officers. Fortunately, I wasn't choked to death for 8 minutes and 46 seconds, but I have never forgot that experience.
Despite that experience, Toney argues schools need police to protect students from threats like shooters. Ryan Petty agrees with the sheriff. He lost his 14-year-old daughter, Elena, in the Parkland school shooting.
Look, I'm a father that lost a daughter, and I can say the words. These are low probability events, but they're high impact.
Petty is white and now sits on the Florida Board of Education. He worries if police aren't on campuses, dozens of students could be injured or killed while waiting for them to arrive and confront a shooter. Even though he acknowledges in Parkland, the school resource officer, SRO, never went in.
The SRO stood outside my daughter's school for 48 minutes.
That, he says, isn't an argument for no police officers in schools, but for better ones. For NPR News, I'm Jessica Bakeman.
Is the nation's capital is Washington, D.C.? Is the nation's capital? Is the nation's capital?
It was a summer photo op that has continued to reverberate. In June, let's remember, federal police used smoke and tear gas to clear a crowded park near the White House for the president. That move violated part of a court-ordered settlement, according to lawyers who helped write it. The settlement says federal officers had to warn protesters in a very specific way before using aggressive tactics. Dina Temple-Reston from NPR's investigations team has more.
There were peaceful protesters in Lafayette Square near the White House on June 1st, marching, chanting, and then this happened. At about 6:30, half an hour before a citywide curfew was supposed to go into effect, police advanced and with seemingly little warning fired tear gas and smoke canisters into the crowd. This was just before President Trump walked across Lafayette Square to pose for a photograph in front of St. John's Episcopal Church. The problem with how this unfolded is that if police wanted to clear the area, they had to warn the protesters first, and they had to do so loudly so people who didn't want to be arrested could get away. The rules of engagement on D.C. streets were part of a settlement agreement reached in 2015. It ended a class action lawsuit filed on behalf of people who were caught up in the mass arrests in D.C. in 2002. Mara Verhalian-Hilliard founded the Partnership for Civil Justice Fund, which represented some of the hundreds of people arrested back then.
They were held for 24, 27 hours or more. People were hogtied in stress and duress positions, wrist to ankle.
A U.S. federal judge approved a settlement agreement that spelled out, in detail, exactly how police in D.C. needed to warn protesters before moving in.
These procedures are very particular. They include, and that's why we wrote them this way, not just that they have to give notice and opportunity, they have to have officers at the farthest reaches of a demonstration who are certifying that they've heard that notice.
But instructions from the police in Lafayette Square on June 1st were hard to hear.
A citywide curfew is in effect. 7 p.m. tonight until 6 a.m.
The House Committee on Natural Resources had a hearing in July to understand what happened in Lafayette Square that night.
Was the protocol followed to give three warnings?
Acting Chief of the Park Police, Gregory Monahan, was one of the people who testified.
Yes, sir, the protocol was followed. There were three warnings given, and they were given utilizing a long-range acoustic device. It's called an LRAD, and that's what it stands for. That was the device used.
The LRAD is a kind of sound cannon that emits a piercing noise. A U.S. Park Police spokesman told NPR that Chief Monahan stands by his testimony. But a whistleblower has come forward saying the opposite.
On June 1st, I served as a liaison between the District of Columbia National Guard and the Park Police at Lafayette Square.
That's Adam DeMarco. He's a major in the D.C. National Guard. He told the House committee that he was 30 yards away from the officer giving the warnings, and he could barely hear him. And that announcement, he testified, didn't come from an LRAD.
The warnings were conveyed using a megaphone near the statue of President Andrew Jackson. From where I was standing, approximately 20 yards from the demonstrators, the announcements were barely audible, and I saw no indication that the demonstrators were cognizant of the warnings to disperse.
DeMarco is now a military whistleblower. His attorney, David Loftman, says his client was uniquely positioned to see the events unfold. Verhaden Hilliard, the lawyer who filed that original lawsuit, thinks its terms were violated on June 1st. She expects to file a new or related lawsuit that says so. Dina Temple-Raston, NPR News.
Yeah. I want to be a cop. Can you keep your lips sealed? I think with leadership skills can turn low-level offenders into crisp bills. You know, I've always wanted to be a cop.
For months, protests over the police-involved killings of Breonna Taylor, George Floyd, and others reinvigorated an intense debate over policing. Then the mayor of Louisville, Kentucky, announced the city would pay $12 million to Breonna Taylor's family and institute a number of police reforms. That highlighted an aspect less discussed, the financial impact of police misconduct on cities and taxpayers. NPR's Cheryl Corley reports.
Cities can face hundreds of lawsuits every year, charging, among other things, that police used excessive or deadly force or made a false arrest. Many times details of settlements are hidden behind confidentiality agreements. UCLA law professor Joanna Schwartz studies how jurisdictions budget and pay for police legal expenses. She says although payouts can total in the millions, more often they are in the thousands of dollars range and with an important determining factor.
The number of cases filed and the number of dollars that are paid to resolve cases depends very much on where in the country you live.
Claims against big city police departments cost taxpayers about $300 million last year. One of the arguments in the ongoing protests over policing is that money for police could be better spent elsewhere. And the clash between protesters and police following the death of George Floyd in Minneapolis means Minneapolis and other cities could face a myriad of legal costs. In Chicago, several groups work to resolve cases of people who've been wrongfully convicted. 2 years ago, a federal jury awarded $17 million to Jacques Rivera in what's considered one of the largest police misconduct settlements in the city's history.
I say that was kidnapped by the Chicago police wrongfully.
55 years old now, Rivera spent 21 years in prison for a murder he did not commit. Framed, he says, by a now-retired Chicago gang crimes detective, Rivera is one of at least 20 who have been exonerated in cases where that detective led the investigations.
They set out to wrongfully convict me for whatever reasons why, whether if it was just to calm the community, that they got the perpetrator, or whatever it may be. It's still not right because taxpayers have to pay for it. Victims' family have to relive this all over again once they think it's closed. And it's just painful for everybody.
Over the past decade, Chicago has paid about $500 million for police misconduct. Rivera attorney Locke Bowman is the head of the MacArthur Justice Center at Northwestern Law School. He says in cases where misconduct is clear, cities often continue to fight against the allegations for months, sometimes years, and that can mean a hefty price tag for taxpayers.
The decision to settle a case like that early ends up saving money for attorney's fees and can result in a lower settlement before everybody gets dug in and the price of the case goes up.
Insurance policies and local budgets usually pay for judgments and claims. Jurisdictions hurting for cash may borrow, issuing bonds to spread out payments, add bank fees and interest to investors, and those costs pile up, with taxpayers footing the bill for police misconduct. And as COVID-19 devastates budgets nationwide, that could be a more frequent scenario. Chicago City Council Finance Committee Chairman Scott Wagesback says the city is working to break that expensive pattern and concentrating on police reforms.
So that we're not just saying, okay, here's another settlement and good job negotiating it and move on, but really look at the deep-seated issues within the department to start rooting out those problems.
Activists argue tying police misconduct costs to police budgets could help prevent police wrongdoing, as well as making police officers, especially repeat offenders, financially accountable. Currently, so-called qualified immunity rules shield officers from those costs. That's changed in Colorado. State Representative Leslie Herod was the force behind the state's decision to drop its qualified immunity provision. A new law requires officers guilty of wrongdoing to pay up to $25,000.
And that if they were found to have acted in bad faith, violating someone's rights, possibly ending in death, that they actually had to be held personally responsible, just like anyone else who violated their policies and their obligations at their workplace.
The law also allows officers to purchase liability insurance. Other jurisdictions looking to reduce police-related lawsuits may follow that hybrid model of splitting settlement costs between cities and individual officers. That, just as victims or the families of people injured or killed by police misconduct, continue to seek justice. Cheryl Corley, NPR News, Chicago.
$12 million. That is what the city of Louisville, Kentucky, has agreed to pay the family of Breonna Taylor to settle a wrongful death lawsuit. The settlement also comes with the promise of police reforms.
Breonna Taylor, remember, was shot and killed by police who entered her home with what is known as a no-knock warrant. Amina Alahi of member station WFPL in Louisville joins us now. Amina, this settlement closes one aspect of the Breonna Taylor case. This was the civil suit, but where does the criminal case stand right now?
Well, with the civil case now settled, Breonna Taylor's family and lawyers are demanding more attention to the cases that could lead to criminal charges for the officers involved in the raid. There are two in particular that we're paying really close attention to. One is the investigation by the Office of Kentucky Attorney General Daniel Cameron, and another is by the FBI. Announcements from both of them could come soon, but we don't have a definitive timeline. And remember, Breonna Taylor was killed 6 months ago. Her mother, Tamika Palmer, spoke yesterday about the settlement.
Her beautiful spirit and personality is working through all of us on the ground. So please continue to say her name, Breonna Taylor.
Breonna Taylor's mom made clear that she sees this settlement as the beginning of justice for her late daughter. What does she hope will come next?
You're right. She was crystal clear about expecting the officers who shot her daughter to be charged. And what charges? Well, civil rights attorney Ben Crump, who's representing the family, said he wants to see second-degree manslaughter at minimum. That would carry a sentence of 5 to 10 years in prison. For now, Louisville police have fired one officer and placed three on paid leave.
This is the largest settlement of its kind agreed to by the city of Louisville, and one of the largest that also comes with a promise of police reforms, right? What can you tell us about that?
The unusual thing about this settlement is that it includes promises to implement several specific police reforms. One of the reforms promised yesterday is an early warning system designed to keep track of use of force incidents and citizen complaints against officers.
Are these reforms actually going to happen?
Well, when Mayor Greg Fisher was asked about it yesterday, he didn't offer a whole lot of detail, and he didn't specify a timeline for when all of the measures would take effect. It's worth noting that some of these reforms will need to be negotiated with the police union, and contract negotiations are happening now, but the mayor said yesterday that some of the reforms they promised will be discussed with them next year.
All right, reporter Amina Alahi of member station WFPL in Louisville. Thank you so much for sharing your reporting on this, Amina.
You're welcome.
I've been told by those who should know that the most exquisite African flesh in the state of Tennessee is bred right here on your land.
Now, from the look of these black angels, my sources weren't wrong.
They weren't just a damn whistling. Oh, I got my share of coal blacks and horse faces and gummy mouth bitches out there in the field, but the lion's share of my lady niggas is real show ponies.
Gusty Renegade. Here at the Cows and on the compensatory call-in specifically, for years, I have said metaphors. I've stated one of the ways that racists master deceivers, practice deception, they will take two separate entities, two different concepts, and they will insist that these two are identical, exactly alike. They'll compare this and then say, oh, these are similar. This is just like this. Frequently, the two things being compared are not similar at all.
Attorney General Bill Barr is not known for mincing words, but his remarks at a Constitution Day celebration last night are reverberating far beyond the walls of the Justice Department. Barr criticized his own prosecutors and made incendiary comments about slavery and the coronavirus pandemic. With us to talk about what the Attorney General said is NPR National Justice Correspondent Carrie Johnson. Hi, Carrie.
Hi there.
Let's start with Barr's comments on lockdowns over COVID-19. What did he say about that?
A member of the largely conservative audience last night asked Barr about restrictions on attendance at religious ceremonies because of the coronavirus pandemic. The Attorney General pointed out that his Justice Department has been sending letters to state and local governments about religious freedom. And then he started talking about proposals for a national stay-at-home order. Let's take a listen.
Other than slavery, which was a different kind of restraint, this is the greatest intrusion on civil liberties in American history.
Now, the reaction to those comments was swift. The highest-ranking black lawmaker in the House of Representatives, Jim Clyburn, called those comments by Barr among the most ridiculous, tone-deaf, and awful things he's ever heard.
Another striking element of Barr's speech is that most of it seemed to focus on his own employees at the Justice Department.
Absolutely. This was a very unusual case of an attorney general calling out career prosecutors as a permanent bureaucracy, one that Barr says is sometimes motivated by politics. He said too many prosecutors are looking for high-profile targets to go after. He called them headhunters. And then Bill Barr said this.
And as I say to FBI agents, whose agent do you think you are? Now, I don't say this in a pompous way. But that is the chain of authority and legitimacy in the Department of Justice.
And Sasha, by the way, this morning, the FBI director, Christopher Wray, told Congress that his agents work on behalf of the American people.
And this, of course, is not happening in a political vacuum. Critics have accused Bill Barr of interfering in cases to help allies of President Trump, people like Presidential Advisor Roger Stone, former National Security Advisor Michael Flynn. So, Carrie, in that larger context, how are these comments landing?
You know, Bill Barr never mentioned the Stone or Flynn cases by name, but they definitely appear to be on his mind. The attorney general says he's the ultimate decider at the Justice Department. He says prosecutors need supervision, and he likened some of his own workforce to little kids.
Letting the most junior members set the agenda might be a good philosophy for a Montessori preschool, but it is no way to run a federal agency.
Now, no surprise, this speech offended some former Justice Department employees. One of them is Jody Hunt, who tweeted his support last night for the career workforce. Hunt was an assistant attorney general at the Justice Department until he left that job earlier this year. And other prosecutors pointed out that even though Bill Barr has previous experience at the Justice Department, he actually has never prosecuted a case. He's done other things there.
Carrie, you've been on the justice beat for a long time, and so you know that there is often or always political controversies there. Is there anything about this moment with Bill Barr that stands out to you?
You know, certainly we've had some very controversial attorneys, General Ed Meese in the Reagan years, Eric Holder under President Obama, and then Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez and Michael Mukasey under President George W. Bush. The difference this time is that Bill Barr seems to go out of his way to touch the third rail. He really seems to relish this combat with reporters and his own workforce. I'm not sure what the upside is for Barr to pick a fight with his employees right now, but maybe he just likes to get a rise out of people. He certainly has succeeded at that, Sasha. This afternoon, his spokeswoman, Carrie Kupak, has pointed out that some of his speech may have been misrepresented, and she urged people to read his words for themselves.
That's NPR's Carrie Johnson, who covers the Justice Department. Carrie, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
His name and the voice coming
straight out of Compton.
For 4 hours today, the civilian commission that oversees the Los Angeles Sheriff's Department debated how to respond to recent events, and some members even called on Sheriff Alex Villanueva to resign. An ad hoc committee will now decide if they should formally call for his resignation. Now, this meeting was taking place just days after two sheriff's deputies were shot in the head while sitting in their patrol car in Compton. Now, both deputies were in critical condition for days. One has been released from the hospital. The shooter has not yet been found. Joining us now is KPCC's Frank Stoltz. He's been covering today's meeting. Now, Frank, before we get to the hearing, what can you tell us about the search for the shooter who ambushed the two deputies on Saturday night?
Yeah, there have been two interesting developments since the ambush. First, sheriff's officials issued a description of the suspect as a black man between the ages of 28 and 30. That's a very narrow age range, which could suggest they have a good idea of who they're looking for. Second, detectives say the suspect jumped into a black four-door sedan, possibly a Mercedes sedan, and they have not ruled out that there was a getaway driver involved. Sheriff Alex Villanueva has only said they have promising leads. This is a massive manhunt, as you can understand, with the FBI and U.S. Marshals Service helping. And, of course, every cop in L.A. on high alert in the wake of the ambush.
Did that ambush come up in that oversight hearing? What was said?
Yeah, it did, right at the beginning. Everybody denounced the shooting, of course, with Commissioner Robert Bonner calling it a despicable act and a low point in L.A. law enforcement history. And he expressed concern about a proposed resolution condemning the attack. Part of the commission's resolution said the residents of Compton deserve to live free of violent incidents that further ignite community trauma. It was a reference, in part, to deputy shootings. Bonner worried about connecting deputy shootings with the ambush.
Certainly, we don't want to say anything or express any sentiment in this resolution that could be mistaken by anyone as ever justifying homicidal attacks or violence on deputies or other police officers.
In the end, the commission included the language. Here's Commissioner Priscilla Ochin.
We aren't here to take sides. We are here to try to build bridges and to come up with solutions. I think that we need to acknowledge the pain and frustration of communities who are being afflicted by constant violence.
Hey, the move infuriated one Altadena resident who tweeted that equating the ambush of the deputies with incidents involving deputies who may be confronted with armed suspects as nonsense.
Now, Frank, didn't Bonner talk about possibly Alex Villanueva resigning? How significant was that?
Well, we have to remind ourselves who Robert Bonner is. He is a former federal judge who once ran the DEA. He is very much pro-law enforcement. But today, he said, with great reluctance, he's taking a step to call on the sheriff's resignation. He said it's become apparent that Sheriff Villanueva lacks the judgment to be sheriff. And he cited a number of things, 10 in all. One was his rehiring of a deputy who had been fired over domestic violence allegations. That deputy had been a political aide to the sheriff. He also cited policy that Villanueva had written about getting rid of cliques. He said that the sheriff is not enforcing that policy. And finally, he said that there's been no sheriff in modern history that has such a bad relationship with the Board of Supervisors. And Bonner said that relation is key to a well-functioning sheriff's department.
All right. Now, the committee also discussed the case of our colleague, KPCC reporter Josie Huang. Now, to remind listeners, while she was covering protests outside the hospital where the deputies were being treated, Josie videotaped the arrest of a protester. Then sheriff's deputies restrained and pinned her to the ground. She was then arrested for obstructing justice. Frank, what did the committee have to say about this?
Again, they expressed a lot of concern. In fact, the commission formally asked Inspector General Max Huntsman to investigate her arrest, something he actually already said he'd do. In comments to the commission, Huntsman said videos he's looked at indicate the deputies wrongfully arrested her. He also said her arrest came in a context. There had been other alleged efforts by deputies to block journalists from doing their job, including an incident where a deputy shined his high-power flashlight into the camera of a Fox 11 reporter in an effort to prevent them from filming an arrest.
My office is investigating recent Sheriff's Department actions which may violate the United States Constitution's guarantee of freedom of the press. In these investigations, we have requested the cooperation of the Sheriff's Department and not received it.
And another incident, where deputies claimed they had been asked by a businessman to clear out civil rights attorneys holding a press conference outside the South LA station. But it turns out the conference was not being held on that businessman's property, according to the inspector general.
Wow. All right. Now, one committee member pointed out that both journalists and protests are protected by the Constitution. And a public commenter called in to ask the committee what the media guidelines are for the sheriff's department. So, Frank, you cover them all the time. What are sheriff's deputies allowed to do and what is not allowed?
Yeah, and you know this too. I mean, the main issue for any law enforcement agency is that reporters do not get in the way of police work, of investigations. They can move you out of any area where you might be stomping on evidence, for instance, or endangering a deputy. But it's always a bit of a give and take. You know, they want you as far away as possible. Reporters want to get as close as possible. Different agencies behave differently. We should point that out. Under Sheriff Villanueva, we see these growing concerns that he is preventing reporters from exercising their First Amendment rights.
All right. Finally, the Civilian Oversight Committee was set up to help with public transparency and accountability with respect to the Sheriff's Department. But the members talked at length today about how they're limited in what they can actually do if the sheriff refuses to cooperate with them. So what are the limits of their power, Frank?
Well, they do have subpoena power. Voters gave it to them in March. But the first subpoena they issued, the sheriff ignored. The sheriff believes this is a biased commission, not supportive of his department. Months ago, he quit sending representatives to the meetings. So the commission is left with the bully pulpit, and that's about it right now. I mean, it's going to be going to court here to try to enforce its subpoena. But for now, really, it's the bully pulpit. And there is this growing concern the department is using excessive force at demonstrations. And of course, we saw a summer of demonstrations. And at the meeting, this came up again and again with people who spoke, including this man who identified himself as TK.
How they opened fire on peaceful protesters with no dispersal orders, no unlawful gathering orders. A 7-year-old was sprayed with pepper balls. Multiple people were hit with rubber bullets.
And again, compounding all of this is the deteriorating relationship between the sheriff and this oversight commission and the inspector general and the Los Angeles County Board of Supervisors. He's really a bit isolated right now. And now there are calls for his resignation from members of the commission. It's not getting any better.
So, Frank, what happens next? I mean, we got into a lot of stuff there, but what happens next?
Well, if you want to do the immediate next, the sheriff holds a news conference this afternoon to talk about a controversial South L.A. shooting. He's going to answer some of these concerns that we raised today. And there's a court battle over the subpoenas that the commission has issued. So that's what's next.
All right. That's KPCC's Frank Stoltz. Frank, thank you very much.
Thanks.
That he saw a Be on the Lookout post with his face on it. He and his attorney say they have no idea who started these accusations.
It just put my face out there real fast.
33-year-old Compton resident Darnell Hicks, a father to two girls and a youth football coach, feared for his safety and his family's after being wrongfully accused on social media of ambushing two L.A. County Sheriff's deputies Saturday. Attorney Brian Dunn with the Cochran firm.
He has no connection whatsoever. Any person would suffer greatly when falsely accused of a crime, especially a crime as heinous as this.
As a manhunt was underway for the shooter seen in this video, social media posts with an unknown origin started circulating with Hicks' driver's license photo, address, license plate number, naming him as a possible suspect, calling him armed and dangerous. He started getting death threats.
You know, I have two daughters, and I don't even feel safe taking them out no more now.
He simply has been thrown into this pit for nothing other than the color of his skin.
The sheriff's department initially described the shooter only as a dark-skinned male. After these posts surfaced, authorities tweeted, "There's a social media post that is being circulated. This is erroneous information. There are no named or wanted suspects at the time."
There was some bad information that floated around yesterday about a suspect and a photo and the vehicle and all that information is false.
Whoever keep framing me, making it seem like I shot two sheriffs when I was out dirt biking all Saturday, come on now.
There has been a complete blackout in terms of the information, where it has come from. No one has taken responsibility for it.
I got my own clothing line. I do a lot of business on my own. And it's like people looking at me differently now.
So when you have a case of mistaken identity, what if he would have been killed? What if somebody would have thought, a deputy or anyone would have thought that he was really the wanted suspect?
For Hicks, the damage is done.
I just want to send my prayer to the two deputies that was injured in this incident. I want them to know that I'm innocent. It don't have nothing to do with me. And for any other black man out there, just be aware, because the description was a black male. So it could happen to anybody.
And Hicks said one of the posters claimed that their account had been hacked. Live in Hancock Park, Kimberly Chang, KTLA 5 News.
The Cows, context of white supremacy. Gusty Renegade in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Saturday, September 19, 2020. So I have been told. We should be here tomorrow, our global Sunday talk on racism, 3 p.m. Eastern, 2 p.m. Central, 12 noon Pacific, Sunday early afternoon. We'll chat it up about what is happening on the planet, get our international perspective. Tune in if you have questions, want to take advantage talk to some different folks about the system of white supremacy, the Rona election, whatever it is. That's tomorrow. Dr. Ruby Lathan will be on the broadcast. Good to hear from her once again. We can get more tips on diet. I think one of our listeners just asked about the importance, or I think he didn't ask about the importance. His question was specifically about, is it even necessary to have a diverse diet? You know, is it possible that you can find nourishing foods and you just have very similar meals on a daily basis, as opposed to diversifying what you eat? We'll make sure to ask about that and other comments, tips people might ask or people might have about transitioning, eating better, encouraging offspring, other family members. I think we did have some folks who said that they had family members who kind of scoffed at transitioning to more plant-based whole food diet. We can ask for tips on helping out with that. Get a blender. I can't say that enough. Again, you don't have to get one of these, you know, highfalutin $10,000 machines. You do not have to do that at all. I certainly have posted a lot of different concoctions that I've made with my Vitamix and what have you. They are great, but I mean, you do not have to get the most expensive blender. I made lots of wonderful smoothies and other great meals using a blender that was way cheaper than a Vitamix for quite some time. You do not have to. And it's so helpful if you just have a good quality blender. You can make smoothies. You can make desserts. You can make soups. You can make so many things. That's why I try to post lots of pictures. I made vegan pesto this week. I made that several times this summer, but the vegan pesto was amazing. It's just can just get you in a daily habit of making things yourself and using fresh veggies and just having really tasty, nutritious meals. So get a blender. That can be a big help in transitioning to more fruits, veggies, and raw fruits, veggies. Anywho, but Dr. Lathan, she'll be with us this Wednesday, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. If you have questions about diet, nutrition, cooking, preparing meals, all of that, feel free, dial in on Wednesday, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. Let's see. The segment on the L.A. Sheriffs. We just had that big report 2 weeks ago. Dejon Kizzy, black male. I'm sure everybody knows all about him. Great illustration of black male privilege. He shot, who knows, dozens of times, right? I think they later said that they had video. I certainly am not going to watch that. But I think they got through that entire report without even mentioning the name Dejon Kizzy. That's actually two reports that we heard about the L.A. sheriffs. No, didn't even mention his name. Also didn't mention the recent report about the executioners, because we just played that report about this is a gang within the L.A. Sheriff's Department. And they're talking about you want to get inked up. You go out and shoot someone, maybe a Dejon Kizzy, and, oh, now you got some rank. And that's Welsing moment right there, getting a tattoo. A white enforcement official, you get a tattoo for killing probably a non-white person. Justifiable homicide. Dr. Welsing has a whole chapter in the ISIS papers about this sort of thing. Anyway, but they do that whole report without mentioning their names. I thought that was not an accident. I mean, you could call it, I guess, at best, I would say that's sloppy journalism. Really poor reporting. Right? They got the whole say her name movement. You know, this just happened, all of these incidents, and we don't even get a name of Dejon Kizzy and how many shots? At best, sloppy journalism could just be racism, white supremacy, black male privilege. Let's see. With the shooting that took place, that's the type of thing also, any of these shootings of police officers, that also supports 4 more years. Same type of thing happened. Remember that? So much of this feels, I mean, we obviously didn't have the Roma, but a lot of this feels very similar to 2016. They had the police shooting in Dallas of those officers. They got a lot of attention. Remember that one? I think they had another shooting in Louisiana, maybe. But I definitely remember those, the officers in Texas. But it was a few of those officer shootings, and they were using the rhetoric of war on cops. That became a part of our current president's campaign slogan and rhetoric heading into his November victory. But that sort of thing, I think, helps our current president's reelection campaign. And that is a moment where I say, because it reminded me of 2012, talking about elections. So what took place right after President Obama was reelected? So we're talking January, February 2013, Christopher Dorner. Right after the election, they had Mr. Dorner do his shooting in L.A., if I'm not mistaken, Southern California, black male, and the same thing. Stand by your work. I am sure there are people who, you know, jump up and down and celebrate. Right on, black brother. He shot those officers. Maybe they were in the executioner. None of that. I am of the opinion none of that should be celebrated. Killing people is not anything to be celebrated, even if, you know, it should be done if it is a just killing. That's not, you know, stand up and let's have a parade because we killed a person. That is total white supremacy culture. Two, stand by your work. Christopher Dorner, it's many reasons that that shouldn't be celebrated. He killed a black person. I mean, what the world? Anyway, we talked about all that before. Anyway, stand by your work. I played that final segment, Mr. Hicks, falsely accused that he's the shooter. That also happened with Christopher Dorner, where they had lots, because he was on the run, as they say, for a number of days following the initial shootings. And it was the same thing. They had a so-called manhunt, and they random black man. Oh, that's him. Oh, that's the Negro. Oh, that's the Negro. That sort of thing is common, even when it was Mark Essex. Common. Negro on the run. And the retaliation, even once we got him, it's going to be vengeance. Got to get, you know, go upside the head of 50 or 500 other Negroes as payback for what that one Negro did. Anyway, stand by your work. I think there's a reason Mr. Fuller says that and has very specific details with regards to maximum emergency compensatory action, as outlined in his code book, edited edition, that way we don't have this sort of thing where a killing happens, a shooting happens, and then we got a manhunt and they're grabbing the wrong person because we don't know who did it. Nah, I did it. I should have done it. And anybody that's got a problem with it, nah, don't you go over there molesting Mr. Hicks and, oh, he did it, and, oh, this nigger did it, and I did it. Announce it to the universe. I did it. Anybody has a problem with it, come see me. That's the way you're supposed to operate. Not all this running and they got to go and roust other black people. They did the same thing here. You've seen this enough. That is the type of thing where I look and say, oh, wow, we really do not stop and process, because it's not like this is a brand new thing, right? Mark Essex, Christopher Dorner, we all should know what happens when this sort of thing goes down. I forgot the one in 2015, he did the shooting in New York, allegedly. He went from Baltimore to New York, no less, to do the shooting. I forgot his name. I wrote about that one. It was quite a few. It's been a number of these. I've never seen where any of these weakens the system of racism, white supremacy, or improves things for black people in any way, shape, form. In fact, it generally does the exact opposite. No improvement at all. As I said, retribution. They go, I think, that's in the book, Mark Essex. As I said, they got a whole book about that, got a whole chapter. They gunned down Mark Essex, shot him 200 times, literally. And then they went bam, we're going to go beat down a whole so-called neighborhood of black people. Payback. Very, very common. As I said, we've seen this sort of thing many, many times. If anybody can think of a time where a report, an allegation that a black person went and shot some police officers and that improved things for black people, make sure you are the first person to dial in. 720-716-7300. The code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate, and for sure don't spectate if you can think of a time. Did Christopher Dorner make things better for black people in California? Maybe I missed that. Maurice Clemens, that was right here. That was the other case I was thinking of. That was right here in Seattle where he, a black male, allegedly killed four officers and was on the loose for a number of days. That was 2009. We were broadcasting at that time. We talked to Mr. Fuller about that as it was that was the same time as Tiger Woods got in trouble. They were reporting that simultaneously the first year of the Obama presidency. But we talked about that case. I don't remember things improving for black people. In fact, I remember the enforcement officers being extremely aggressive and gloating when they finally killed Maurice Clemens. In fact, I remember having some of the photographs. You know, they have those websites where it'll just be where officers can go and post and gloat about how they killed Eric Garner or Tamir Rice or whoever the nigger is for that week. They did the same thing with Maurice Clemens. They went on and posted photographs of his dead body right on. Burn in hell, Mo. Ha, ha, ha. And then they aggressively prosecuted all of his family members who they said helped him and were accomplices and went after them. Bam, 5 years of Fed time for you. All of that. There was no improvement for black people. But if you want to, you know, that's white supremacy culture, in my opinion, being applauding and celebrating death, even a just, righteous killing. Applauding and so all of that is white supremacy culture. None of that is helping us solve any problems or improving the quality of life for black people. Ask Mr. Hicks, is your life better as a result of this shooting of these LA sheriffs? Next. The report, it was at the beginning. They talked about in Mexico, in certain of the areas, not the entire so-called country, they are going to put restrictions on what they call junk food. You can't go into the store and just, if you are a minor, a child, and just buy, you know, a gallon of soda pop and pork rinds and, you know, free Cheetos. We love the Cheetos. You cannot just go in and load up on Cheetos and all the rest of it. Wow. Now they have a sugar tax here in Seattle. I told you they got no plastic. You can't get straws. They got wooden spoons. They don't do all that. They got the recycling super green, as they say, but they have a sugar tax, in the greater Seattle area. So if you go to the store and you buy, like a Coca-Cola, Pepsi, even like a tea, any beverage concoction, even if it's like a smoothie, but if it has sugar added, there's a sugar tax. Now, they've had this for some years now here in Seattle proper. They have said that there has been a significant decrease in the purchase of sugary beverages as a result of the sugar tax. However, they're not sure if that is offset by people just going outside of Seattle proper to purchase all of their sodas and sugary beverages where they don't have that sugar tax. So, but it looks like it might at least have some effect, some impact at reducing the consumption of these sugary drinks here in Seattle. So they're trying this out in Mexico, connecting it to COVID-19. We'll bring that up with Dr. Lathan again. I don't know. I think they tried that sugar tax in some other areas, and I think it passed in some areas. It didn't pass in some other areas. I mean, they got lots of ways, lots and lots of access to bad food in this part of the world, particularly in areas with a lot of black people. They got McDonald's aplenty and all the rest. I mean, I couldn't imagine them having that sort of limit, like your child couldn't go to a McDonald's and get, you know, a cheeseburger, a Big Mac, or whatever it is without having a guardian or parent there. Like, that it would seem difficult for that sort of thing to pass here, but I don't know. What you eat is very important, though. COVID-19, they connected it to the Rona, right? Let's see. Man. This here is the compensatory call-in, yes? 4 years. A number of folks. You know, that Gusty Renegade is a coon. He doesn't know what he's talking about. He's crazy. Certainly ignorant. The whole way that he conceptualizes racism, white supremacy is a waste of time and moronic. That might be true. One component that I have advocated for years, metaphors. A lot of people, they don't even pay enough attention to that. I've never said that no one should use metaphors ever. I've never said that. We're supposed to be paying attention to words. I've never said that metaphors are not useful. They can serve as a constructive value. People have been using them for years. I use them. What I have said consistently and explicitly on this broadcast, the compensatory call-in, is that suspected race soldiers like Attorney General Bill Barr, they are phenomenal, the best in the known universe. They will make a comparison. They will take two entities and say, oh, this is just like this. These are twins, basically. These are identical. You see that? Bill Barr, he was just bam, bam, bam. He started off the metaphors. He starts off. Now, these Rona restrictions, forcing people to stay in their house and wear masks, and this is the greatest civil liberties violation since slavery. Really? Really? Now, I'm just even going to pause because mostly what I've seen this year is not, you know, you leave your house without a mask and we got the nigger dogs that we're going to sick on you. I haven't seen that this year. Do they have you all seen any like reward posters, like they put a bounty on such and such because they were having a Rona party with 50 people over at the house and everybody was eating finger food with no gloves and masks on, sitting around watching, you know, basketball or Netflix binging? Have you all seen that? Because I haven't seen that. Have you all seen anybody? We got toilet paper. You're going to have to let me rape your child. Give you this toilet paper. Has that been going on? Did I miss those reports? Because I haven't seen that happening at all. Maybe if you know about that happening, make sure you don't spectate and dial in immediately, because that would trump anything that I have reported thus far. That's number one on the comparison. But most of what I've seen this year is not people feeling as though their civil liberties have been violated. Most of what I have seen is the report that we heard. I'm free white and 21. I know they got college rules and regulations, but I'm going to have my friends over and we're going to play Call of Duty, all 20 of us, with no shirt on. Matter of fact, we might even have a party and do jello shots from each other. I'm free, white, and 21. That's what I've pretty much seen all year long. Not white people having their civil liberties violated as a result of the Rona. I have not seen that at all. If you all can point that out to me anywhere in the U.S., *61, get that hand up. Much obliged. So he starts off there. Then he goes talking about what they call the junior officials at the Justice Department and compares it to allowing the junior staff at the folks at the Montessori to decide what's going to happen. Eloquent with the Montessori. A lot of folks are, what Montessori? What is he talking about? That? Wow. Wow. That's why I say pay attention. And you see, that didn't, you know, that wasn't just, oh, that's cute or what have you. They interrogated every aspect of those analogies. Like, wow, he's comparing staff at the Justice Department to children and saying that they're not mature, responsible enough to make these decisions about what's going to happen. Like, wow, they do exactly what I suggest. You unpack those metaphors, because a lot of times, wow, They are practicing deception and or they are making really interesting comparisons. If you just, hey, let's unpack what's being said here. Let's not just rush through this analogy, comparison, simile. Much obliged, Attorney General Barr. I think he's a Trump supporter. I think they share that four more years. But that's why on this broadcast I say the system of white supremacy, the book we're reading right now, which is extraordinarily lame, Isabel Wilkerson's Cased, The Origins of Our Discontents. We're two sessions in, so we're pretty early. But it's lots of metaphors. She didn't write this way in The Warmth of Other Suns, which is a metaphor, but that book has a lot of evidence, facts, history. That's not what Cased has been thus far. Maybe that will change, but thus far it's been lots of metaphors. You have to be very cautious, suspicious, alert when you're talking about racism and people, anybody, white person or non-white person, they are not conversing with you using logic, evidence. They're using a lot of rhetoric, analogies. You're not getting details. Right. To make my point, I'll even use a metaphor because they can be instructive. When they say that rhetoric of progress, you need details, you need precision to make sense of progress. If we're taking a trip and we're going to go from New York to California, now when you say progress, I don't need you to tell me about our progress. I can evaluate for myself because I know exactly where we are supposed to be. The goal of this project is California. We're going to see the executioners. Okay. Now, if I see, wait a minute, that sign said, welcome to Boston. I thought we were going to California. Now, I can make sense of whether or not we're making progress because I have precision. We have exactness about what we're trying to accomplish. That's what we don't get with racism, white supremacy. We end up with lots of rhetoric and analogies, not helpful. On this broadcast, if we can be exact, precise, specific with what it is we are saying, that would be appreciated. I will prompt about the metaphors. Much obliged. We are listener-supported, counter-racist radio. Invest if you think the program is constructive. You can visit my blog, racism-notes.blogspot.com. racism-notes.blogspot.com. PayPal button is in the top right corner. If you're not into PayPal, Cash App should be linked there as well. The address for Cash App, cash.app/$thecows. Much obliged for all the investors who have helped keep the cows on for 11 plus years. I hope the program has helped non-white people, victims of racism, get a more accurate understanding of what white supremacy racism is and how it works, and suggestions on things that we can and should be doing to get this problem solved as soon as possible. Amazon wish list should be linked on the blog as well. It's listed under Gus T. Renegade. Much obliged for all the folks who have supported via the wish list. I do have a MacBook Pro even on my wish list. As I said, I've been having massive computer problems, massive enough that it could, in fact, disrupt the Cows broadcast. So hopefully we have earned enough over these 11 and a half years to get a new computer so that we do not have any interruptions to the broadcast. Next, let's see. It was many times, I was going to say was as though it was a singular event. I've heard a number of people suggest that the COVID-19 situation is somehow weakening the system of white supremacy racism. I don't think that that is true. If folks that are listening in, if you think that that's true, if you could point to specific evidence as to why you think that that's true, I would be curious about that. There's nothing that I could point to. You have white sacrifice in a system of white supremacy. I'm aware of certain white people who've either lost businesses or white people with the fires who've lost their houses and what have you. Some of them even died. Other white people who say, you know, they're having a tough time and don't have a place to stay or don't have a biscuit or Cheetos to eat even. You have white sacrifice in the system of racism, white supremacy. That, in my view, does not signal a weakening of the system. I also do not see, in my view, things that would really stand out in terms of metrics of this system being replaced with justice. Massive improvement in the quality of life of black people having more resources, logic at their disposal and how they function in the universe. I don't see any of that. Not on a personal level, not on a macro level, like none of the above. If you all see any evidence of how this is weakening the system of white supremacy, racism in any way, I guess that's something we can ask our listeners globally, because maybe, you know, I don't know, maybe from London, it looks like, yeah, you know, this is really messing things up, and black people here are doing great, non-white people here are doing phenomenal, their problems are getting solved, and these type of things are happening, all right, but that does not seem to be the case here, and I don't see any evidence of that anywhere else. But if you see that type of thing, the number is 720-716-7300, the code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Say briefly before we get in, I think Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, I think she passed away during the broadcast for Neutralizing Workplace Racism yesterday. I'm not sure, but it was pretty close to when we were live on air. A lot of historic things have happened while we have been broadcasting live. I think you might be able to add that one as well. But it will be, or at least I'll be paying attention to see, because just like in 2016 when Justice Scalia passed away, and I think that was just after he had made his comments about how black people might need to go to kind of a more juvenile law school because they're not too intelligent. They can't handle all the rigors of, you know, regular grown white people law school. Maybe we put Clarence Thomas in charge of all this. But right after he had made those comments, he died. And they said, oh, no, we're not going to let that, you know, no count President Obama nominate a new Supreme Court justice. I mean, there's no way. We got to have a new president to come in. We're going to let the people decide who is going to fill that vacancy on the Supreme Court justice. Put your sooty hands on the court and have you picking it up. So it would be very, because that, I think that happened at the beginning of 2016 when Justice Scalia passed away. So this is happening at the end of, I mean, the election is literally days away. So it would be, whew, substantially, I remember a number of white people were staunchly opposed. Like, there is no way we are going to allow for a nomination. They wouldn't even hear it. Like, we're not even going to have a vote on whether or not, you know, this Negro selection is qualified. Wait till after the election. Four more years. So we shall see if they pick it up at this late date, if they allow President Trump to nominate a successor. Folks who dialed in with a hand up, *61, if you could take 5 minutes to share your thoughts, observations, comments, if you could use your mute button if you know you are in a noisy environment. It is really helpful to not have to compete with a lot of unnecessary background noise, and if you have the TV on or if just you're shuffling around with the phone, just use your mute button. That is super helpful. That way we can hear everyone easily. Much obliged. *61, first few folks who dialed in with a hand up, line should be open. good. I love it. 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 I love it.
Can it be heard?
Good. I love it. 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 I love it.
Can it be heard? Yes, sir. Retired firefighter. We can hear you.
Yes. Got three things. First one is I heard a couple of days ago on NPR, I think it was, about in Germany, that 29 law enforcement officers in Germany were being investigated on creating a quote-unquote neo-Nazi environment within law enforcement in Germany. And I put emphasis on neo-Nazi. Wasn't the Nazi Party started in the 1930s? You know, and neo, I think, means new. There's nothing new about white people who call themselves Germans becoming what is called Nazis, which is actually, I guess, is a metaphor for racist white supremacists. And how it's spreading in that part of Europe sounds quite similar to what has been said about law enforcement in this part of the world. Just to confirm that we're on the global system of racism, white supremacy. Maybe, I guess, Sunday we will be able to ask Cal's listeners that may be in the Germany area about this. No police in schools. What comes to my mind is the, as I think in your report, I think it was a parent of a dead child that was killed in one of these school shootings, stated that criminal activity is infrequent. Well, shootings, mass shootings are infrequent, but it's certainly necessary for law enforcement, which may be, you know, may be true. But at the same time, I'm thinking about from the standpoint of, you know, in most of these places down here, most of these schools down here, there's only one law enforcement officer, and their primary weapon is a pistol. The people who embark into mass shootings are armed with assault rifles. I'm not sure on the awareness of anybody on this line on the difference between the two, a pistol versus a quote-unquote assault rifle. It is a very prevalent difference between the two. For whoever would be that person that has a pistol, I put it that way, versus a person that has a assault rifle, for various reasons that I don't have time to explain. Gwen Cherry, Miss Gwen, I'm sorry, not Cherry, but Miss Gwen Berry. I think I mentioned her on the program months ago with the platform protests. I am not a fan of symbolic gestures. If I was her, someone close to her, like a quote-unquote sibling and or an attempted parent or an attempted grandparent, and we had, you know, a pretty much frequent relationship with each other, it would have been my suggestion to tell her to do not do something like that. There are some alternatives that she could do. She has suffered a lot. Professional track and field is a lot different from the NFL and the NBA. I don't think they have a bargaining agreement nowhere to the level of a NBA or NFL. And she was hurt very egregiously. I mean, a lot. I wouldn't say as terrible as Mr. Carlos and Mr. Smith, but definitely was hurt a lot, because what takes place is you lose those relationships you have with the sneakers, the sneaker companies. And that was her means to, quote-unquote, make a living. But there are alternatives that one can do, and I don't have time to explain them. What was the question for today, Gus, that you asked?
I think one of them was if the Rona is somehow weakening the system of white supremacy, any evidence?
Oh, no.
True?
I'll just answer that right quick. No. It's not weakening the system of racist white supremacy. No. I guess I don't have to give it an explanation, but I don't think that it is weakening the system of racist white supremacy. If anything, what it's doing is killing a lot of non-white people. And I would say it'd be my estimation that most of those non-white people are non-white people who are racially classified as black. And that's all I have to say. Thank you.
Cannot be heard. Much obliged, retired firefighter. Yes, sir, we can hear you.
Okay. Gus, you asked about already of the police killings, civilian on police killings affecting or helping black people. No. I don't know if you remember the case in Baltimore, Sean Souter. I remember it because I was looking at the developing news story on TV and in Baltimore. So when Sean Souter was shot, the Baltimore Police Department quickly terrorized the Baltimore community. Then they paused. Oh, wait a minute. Sean Souter is involved in an investigation of corrupt police officers. Wait a minute. He's also corrupt. Oh, wait a minute. It was suicide. So that being said, there's no evidence that these acts are beneficial to black people, because it also increases black terrorism by the police department. Matter of fact, I'm looking at the Sun-Times article, and it says Baltimore Police Detective Sean Souter, death was a suicide, case closed. Baltimore Sun. Okay, as far as athletes protesting, it's very risky. The sister who was protesting, I'm in fear of another non-white athlete, and her name is, if it escapes me, I think Osaka. She's a tennis player. And Naomi Osaka, she's a tennis player, and she's been wearing face masks with deceased black people, women and men who have been killed by police. She's Asian and black, Haitian father, Asian mother, black boyfriend who was also in the stands with a shirt called Defund the Police. As far as penalties for protesting, social protesting, mainly when you're protesting on behalf of black people, is risky. So being though that she has not taken any financial hits or the media has not developed a narrative to demonize her, I think that she is financially beneficial to tennis. Mental health in black people. What brings to mind, since also metaphors was brought up, metaphors often used called gaslighting, which means manipulation by physical means into gaslighting, manipulation by physical means into questioning their own insanity. Racist white supremacy has basically, to my conclusion, has done this to the whole black society. So when it comes to mental illness, I think that all black people suffer for some form of mental illness, my assessment. When they was talking about mental illness and the person that was doing the talking was talking about structural racism, I'm trying to get away from saying structural racism and calling it by its name. It's white people, because I find when I start to talk and I also talk to other victims that I mention structural racism, you're not getting to the core of what you're talking about. And when you use that instead of just saying racist white people, I think that it leads to confusion. Police and schools. I don't know if you guys remember the shooting of the mass shooting. I think I'm not sure of the school. It was a school shooting. And unfortunately, it seems like white police officers in school, they are very, very, very quick to abuse black children. But, and as far as retired firefighter was talking about pistols versus assault rifles, and a police officer during this particular police shooting, he hid during a police shooting, and he was outed as being cowardice, and I think he even lost his job, if I'm not mistaken. Parkland. It was the Parkland Sheriff's Department who hid during shooting. And he was basically hiding while this shooting was occurring. I'm pretty sure if it was an unarmed child, that particular police officer would have jumped and would have been heroic in slamming a black child against the ground. So that's to add to what retired firefighter was saying when it comes to assault rifles going up against pistols. That particular police officer had a pistol and he chose to hide. I will close with this. Encounters with police and how, I was in a situation and I was pulled over. And instead, it was a traffic infraction, and the police officer asked me if I had a criminal record, if I had any guns in the car. I'm just, I didn't fight. I didn't flee. I didn't fuss, as Millie Fuller suggested. I answered accordingly, and I left. When I left, I was definitely disturbed from that particular traffic stop, because if I was speeding, what does my criminal record have to do anything? Where I'm going, what does that have to do anything? Whether I have guns in the car, I think if I was a young white man, between 30 and 40, those questions wouldn't have been asked. Same thing happened in New York City. while I was working, driving the truck, but this time it was a black officer.
30 seconds.
He asked if I had any identification and also asked if I had any warrants. So police officers, these encounters with police officers are very tacky as it relates to black people. Close.
Pretty much the whole system does not get any better than tacky. That is about the best we can hope for. That was the other question I asked. I thought I had more than one question. One was about is the Rona weakening the global system of white supremacy? And then the other question about these shootings on enforcement officials, do they benefit black people in any way? Forgot that was the other question I asked as well. Other folks who dialed in with a hand up, if we have missed you totally, if you have commentary to share, line should be open. Proceed. Well, first few folks with a hand up, line should be open.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Is there a lot of static? Okay. What I wanted to speak on first was the commentary about the black female who wrote about her own killing, who the white male, I believe it was a white man, talking about she was I believe he used the term mental health advocate in the community, and she was having what he called a mental health crisis, something like that, and she was shot and killed by second race soldiers and her helpers. Compensatory logic should be promoted by just compensating for the lies we're being told. This black female who was murdered, the fact that she wrote of her murder, I think it draws a direct logical link to a lot of the black females who are terrorized, harassed, assaulted, and murdered by suspected race soldiers and their helpers have some sort of potential contact regularly with the suspected race soldiers. And I think it goes to the book written by Norm Stamper when he described that a high enough percentage of people who join in what's called law enforcement are predators. The black female who was slammed around and ultimately shot and killed by, I think it was in Texas, by a suspected race soldier. And he lived in the same complex she was in. It was supposedly, of course, according to the same story where they wrote about supposed mental health. It said blacks with so-called depression are 10 times as likely to be diagnosed with schizophrenia and bipolarism, whatever those two are, trichotillomania. But if we think of the context of who's telling us the story, the white male who was in the story, the whole delivery was racism, confusion. He used racial injustice, structural racism, that poison, we have to compensate. The way that a refined racist describes the system of white supremacy racism is disembodied. It takes out the people. White people practice white supremacy racism, and we have to compensate for the lying and the evasion of that basic reality when we talk to each other and even in the hearing of each other. We have to compensate for the lies. Because, as they want to project, mental health is at stake. Amos Wilson says something awesome about mental health, and I wrote it down today. And it goes right in line with Dr. Francis Cresswell's and right along with the code and right along with logic, basic logic. The very foundation of mental health is a knowledge of reality, period. And he even wrote, as a psychologist, I'm assuming he means black psychologists who are attempting to solve the problems of our mental dysfunction. He said that we measure mental illness by the degree to which the individual is out of touch with reality. And if you do not know the reality of what he describes as African people, non-white people under white supremacy, you don't know the reality of your own history or your own personality. And what you do and how you react to the world becomes a mystery to yourself. But the code speaks directly to this logic that everything we do is a reaction to the system of white supremacy racism. And as Renithia Tate said, mental health begins with telling yourself the truth every day, because we are in a system where people are lying by inference, by what they project and what they do in coordination with others who are lying to create a reality that denies this basic power dynamic of the system of white supremacy racism. People dedicated to abusing and dominating, period, based on color. That's their basic and most advanced essence of interaction with other people. And they have many helpers, unfortunately, now. Many victims of racism have become masochistic, too, secret sex with whites or wanting to be whites with the projection that they could somehow have the same power to abuse and dominate others. Mr. Fuller brought out the idea that the other day, one of his shows, that confused people usually always will have somebody more confused than them to dominate. And that's unfortunately what a lot of non-white people, we are drawn into doing and taught to do, is follow the whites, do what they do. Find somebody to dominate with lies and deception and manipulation just simply for the sake of dominating them and for maybe material gain or benefit. When this white male 30
seconds.
Spoke, how much, 30 seconds? Okay. He spoke about that there's two systems, structural systems, about the law enforcement officials who killed the black female. They wanted to deliver mental health and what quality of mental health? Well, mental health is telling ourselves the truth every day. That's the foundation of mental health, knowledge of reality. You have to understand racism, what it is and how it works and how we're affected by it and infected by it, and deal with them as they are. Thank you. I'll leave my line. No sex with whites.
Much obliged, sir. Let's see. I'll give out the number again, 720-716-7300, the code 564-943, pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Let's see. Other folks who dialed in, if you have comments to share, line should be, or not everybody, I'm slowly working down the list here. But first few folks who dialed in with a hand up, line should be open. Did want to make sure I said also, all non-white people who are subject to the system of white supremacy, help that system stay in place. It is not possible to be subject to the system of white supremacy and to not help racists. We would all technically qualify as helpers just by being victims of white supremacy. And incidentally, I do think labeling a non-white person as a helper, I think that would qualify as name-calling, unless that non-white person has identified themselves and said, yes, I am a helper of white supremacy racism. That's my title. Call me a helper. That would be name-calling. Again, the most important point, well, that's pretty important, too, because there's a lot of name-calling that is recommended that we avoid. But the more important point, we would all qualify as helpers. That would be another one. If we have anybody here who could truthfully say, I in no way, shape, form, directly, indirectly, at any time, any place, aid racist man, racist woman, racist child in any way, I would love to hear from that person, like, immediately. *61, if such a person exists and is with us on this day in September 2020, year of the Rona. Other folks that we have missed totally, if you have a hand up, proceed. Saw other hands. I don't know if folks are spectating or not. We will be here tomorrow for the Global Sunday Talk on racism. Again, we'll have Dr. Ruby Lathan on the program Wednesday, normal time, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. Will be interesting to hear her thoughts on the diet situation in Mexico. No junk food for minors. I'm not sure if such a – I think that was another question I asked, too, if people think such a law or tax prohibition would – work there again. Like I said, so many outlets for what they call junk food here in the States. It would seem like you would have lots of options and lots of obstacles to getting that sort of prohibition to pass to begin with. But I will at least, you know, check in with Dr. Lathan the middle of the week, see what she has to say about all that. Folks, still spectating. Again, if we have anyone who does not help, racist man, racist woman, make sure you speak up. Folks still spectating, or other folks have commentary to share?
Can I be heard?
Thomas in New York? Yes, sir.
Yes, sir. Unfortunately, I think I do help. I don't want to, but, you know, I do. I guess I got to work. I work for a lot of white supremacists at the stock exchange, so, you know. Coronavirus has done the opposite of weakening the global system of white supremacy. In fact, it has exposed the strength of the system of white supremacy and the power that white people have globally, depending on how you look at the event. Black people who are killed by police or go out and kill police, that does not weaken the system of white supremacy. However, I think black people who decide to take up violence in response to white supremacy has the right to do so, but it doesn't, I haven't seen any evidence where that's going to help. It could make things worse. And in fact, it's not a protest if you participate in a sporting arena. I don't care if you win the race and then stand on the podium with your fist up, you know, or you want to take a knee before the game. That's not a protest. That's symbolism. You're trying to make a symbol, you know, symbolic gesture. That just pisses white people off and puts you in a situation where they can cut off your resources. A protest is, I'm not participating at all. I'm not racing in this event due to these reasons, or I'm not playing in this game until, or I'm not playing another game until these things are done. You know, I've never seen, until this year, I've never seen people do so much protesting and it's no demands. Like, what are you trying to get out of this? Hip hop, the clip you played, artistic movement turned into a very lucrative business for white supremacists. The largest artistic industry isn't music, TV, or movies. It's actually the fashion industry. Those two C's or two G's, or, you know, the right side up and the upside down F, you know, the LV, you know, those logos that exude, you know, to black people and to other white people as well. They resemble affluency and wealth of white people. Those are the highest forms of entertainment. And not until the 2000s has what they call high fashion advertised to black people. They felt like, and I've heard, I can't remember the designer who said it, but when black people wear their clothes, it depreciates the value of their brand. And they didn't fit us right. They mentioned Dapper Dan. I said all that because he was the guy who, you know, you would go and he would take that logo that means so much, that has that perception of value, and stitch it on to something else and make a whole nother outfit out of it that was Gucci, even though it wasn't, you know. But just that perception in early hip-hop and how they took that autism. I believe Gucci and some of those brands sued them, and now that he works for them. They bringing him back now to remake all of the stuff that he made, that they sued him for making. You know, but that's white people. The penalty for students, I personally think that's a bit ridiculous. Kick them out and take their money. You had a black girl who was arrested for not doing her online classes work. You know, they're just creating more injustice with some of these rules. And in a few years, they will be aimed exclusively at black people. They, you know, once they put them out, then they're just going to shift the focus to us. Excuse me. There's been a large amount of racist propaganda that has been pushed by white mainstream media going back to spring, back when they have accurate tests for the COVID-19. People were being disproportionately infected and dying from the virus. They gave a press conference about a vaccination for COVID-19. In fact, the president said he would be rolling them out probably before the election. And when they asked the person there who was the spokesperson what groups were going to get this vaccination first, he mentioned two groups, the elderly and the blacks. So my question is, I'm adding a question. It was glossed over a couple of weeks ago, so I ask it differently this time. And this is for you too, Gus. Are you going to take this vaccination? That's a simple question. Last thing is, you can't fix black mental health while there's a system of white supremacy. White supremacy is what's causing the black mental health. The way white people deal with mental illness is they give you a medication. I was watching a commercial, and one of the side effects to the medication was it may create thoughts of suicide. I'm like, man, they're giving you something that's going to even make you kill yourself. Like, the problem is white people. Until we fix the problem, we're going to have mental health. That's just logic. I mute my line. Thank you.
Much obliged, Thomas, in New York. With regards to your question, I do remember it from a few weeks ago about the vaccine, and I remember my answer then. I have the same answer now, but it further would only be furthered by the reports that I saw more recently, because I recall at the time they were talking about the vaccine. When you asked it previously, it was in August, I think, and President Trump had said, yeah, we're going to have the vaccine be ready by October, by election. And the CDC said then, and again this week, that is not going to happen. Probably no time until they were talking next year, not this year, probably not the beginning of next year, probably sometime later next year. So my conclusion has still been the same. I do not think President Trump, shock, I do not think that he is being truthful here. I do not think that there's going to be a vaccine before the end of this year. So, yeah, whenever it's available, I'll make an assessment. Although the same thing I said then was, number one, because we're in a system of racism, white supremacy, I suspect some non-white people, myself included, might not have a choice. Depending on what happens when they roll this out, white people might decide that everybody has to get this vaccine. And if you don't, well, Rona, as you just said, we got all kinds of new, you know, enforcements and policies. It might be Rona jail for you. So that's one. And then seeing, you know, lots of things by the time this comes out. So it would be the same thing. Such a vaccine doesn't exist. Would have to see lots, and that would be like billions of questions, and might not have a say-so about that policy. That was what I said then. Same thing. Don't think a vaccine will exist this year. Other folks with comments, now there are three questions. Other folks with comments, thoughts this year, number again, 720-716-7300. The code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Let's see. Folks that we missed totally, if there are folks who have a hand up, comments, questions that they would like to add in. If we have not heard from you at all, let me double check, make sure that we didn't miss anyone. And then if we did not miss anyone. If folks have any additional thoughts that they would like to add in, we should have time for that. We have about 30 minutes, maybe less, left in the broadcast. Let's see. All righty. Any other folks, if we heard from you already, if you have any additional thoughts you would like to share, feel free.
Yes, can I be heard again?
Retired firefighter.
I would be reluctant to take the vaccination. Maybe if I'm already infected in by taking the vaccine, it would help my situation. I would strongly consider it then. But otherwise, I would be very patient into not taking that vaccine until I get a consensus of the results of a massive amount of others. As far as that concerned, in the meantime, I would just be doing what I have been doing up until this day, which is the distance. I've already been practicing the social distancing because that's a part of my counter-racist code in itself, is to stay away from a lot of other people unless I have some reason to be around someone else for something constructive. But that'd be my status with that. Once again, the whole idea, which it seems to be some sort of I've started to say hobby, but it's popular to do so. The symbolic gestures. There is a VGQ to it, but there is a lot of alternative things that a non-white person could do. And if I had something to do with it, meaning that that person was an offspring of mine, or some younger person that I have a relationship with, I would certainly would introduce some other ideas to that person. You can't tell people what to do for the most part in itself, but you certainly, if you give a suggestion, I mean, if you give a suggestion of a yes or no, you should also give a suggestion of what else other alternatives can be done. The Olympic track and field thing, well, international track and field thing, they already had, as far as rules are concerned and the consequences of it, they had it all lined up as, before she even did that. They had it all lined up that if you violate these rules, you would be suspended for 12 months. You'd be suspended for 12 months. And on top of it, like I said before, she made her money. She actually started hammer throwing based on a suggestion from a teacher in high school. And she ended up being pretty good at it. And she got a chance to go to college on a scholarship. She had other dreams and ideas other than just track and field. And but she was pretty good at it, of course, world level
And I'm saying that's a platform where you can do a lot of things with, where you actually, you know, with the money you make from the sneakers and whatever, you can invest it into something that that'll be, you know, quite constructive. And it can be ideas at working against the system of racist white supremacy. But not saying that she couldn't do that now, but it makes her situation somewhat more difficult to do so, is what I'm saying. And it goes back to the logic of in the course of solving problems, you make sure that you don't create more. And I would unfortunately say that that's a clinical, classic case of perhaps, you know, creating more problems for yourself. Thank you.
Much obliged, retired firefighter. Just like with the rhetoric, try to avoid just symbolic acts, gestures. I think an important question to ask frequently is, what problem are we trying to solve? And if whatever it is that you are engaged in, if it's not going to be solving a specific problem, might want to reconsider. There might be a better way to invest that time and energy, and always the metric of solving problems without creating new problems. Super important.
Yes, sir.
Very interesting, frequently within the system of white supremacy to accomplish that, because, oh, man, like, just when it looks like you got one problem solved, they will come in and add about 10 more problems to, you know, what you're already dealing with. But that should be what, you know, the effort is to try to accomplish. Incidentally, I will say with that report, I thought that was another example. The white female, she's with St. Louis Public Radio, just when, and it's been tons of those where some white person goes to interview a black person. It can be one of the police shootings. It can be where she's this young lady who's doing her protest or whatever it is, but just the tackiness in the interview where they pretend like they do not understand racism, the word choice where they'll say it's bias or not call it racism at all. Like, I felt like that was another really tacky illustration of white people practicing racism when they go out to report on these types of stories or interviewing victims of racism. Other folks, comments that they wanted to share, thoughts that they wanted to add.
I didn't call them helpers, to not name call them other than I didn't want to call them law enforcers, because the race soldiers, they're enforcing the law of white over not white, so they're law enforcers, but not white people, I guess. Just help. I'm a helper too. So I'll try to figure out something else. Well, they're just victims of racism. An assignment.
I'm still learning myself, sir. Much obliged. Had a lot of suggestions on the accomplice. That's one that's used as well. And just following logic, that would also be name-calling unless the person has said, identified themselves as an accomplice. But I have concluded victim of racism. That would be the most accurate title for really all of us who are classified as not white, unfortunately. We all end up doing a lot of helping, directly, indirect. Gusty as well. I don't know anybody who qualifies who can truthfully put a hand up and say, "Oh yeah, I don't help whites at all. No way, no how, at no time in the known universe." Like you know, losers. That's you all. Like, I'm a 2020 black person, and yeah, I don't help out white people at all. If you find such a person, let me know immediately. I'll give you my number and email, so I would have a whole lot of questions for this fella. Or if it's a female, let me know. Other folks, comments that they wanted to contribute? If you're thinking for a second, that segment we started with, it was a BBC report.
They were talking about the auction, and they were auctioning different things, jackets from some of the hip-hop artists, or you could have a rhyme writing session with Rakim and Dapper Dan, the fashion artist. You could, you know, I guess, I don't know, see some clothes or fashion designs. I don't know what you're going to do with him, but auctioning undervalued talents of black people. I just thought that was how much progress we have made in 2020. And it sounded like they didn't have video with that report. It was audio, but it sounded like those are more white women. The former executive at Tommy Boy, not that I'm surprised. I think it's a white woman who is currently in charge of the Death Row estate. I could be an error, but I think I heard a report on that a few years back. She's currently the person who, you know, the masters and all of that, white woman in charge. So I'm not surprised. White people were in charge of it to begin with, but just, wow, to comment on, and that doesn't get described as white supremacy racism either, the long history of exploitation of black artists, and this auction is now some effort at correcting that and giving attention to these black artists who were exploited for all of these years by all of these white-owned record companies. Remember we had MC Search on the program? Talked about some of that exactly. He owns the, just like in that report, although he's a white man, but same thing, he owns the rights to Nas Illmatic, classic, in the exact time period that they were talking about in that auction of Negro memorabilia. If we had, if we were to do this, this is 2020, so if we were doing this, let's say, 1990, we'll rewind 40 years, it would be the same thing, but like jazz or something of that nature. They would have, like, I don't know, Miles Davis mouthpiece from his saxophone or something like that, you know, Dizzy Gillespie's, you know, traveling case and all the rest of it, you know. Billie Holiday, this is the gown that she sung in before we killed her, that type of thing. Other folks, commentary you would like to share before we wrap things up? Other responses to the questions that were asked about the vaccine improvements, if these shootings of police officers improves things for black people, or I think there was, if the Rona is actually weakening the system, global system of white supremacy. Any other responses to the questions? Get those in as well.
I would say the shooting of white law enforcement will not cause the end of racism and white supremacy at all. It would justify more retaliation on non-white black people in many significant different ways, with more advanced weaponry and also more intense encounters with non-white people on top of it. Basically, what is missing, and I'm going to quote Mr. Fuller, is we do not have a counter-racist, collectively, we don't have a counter-racist code based on logic. That's what's the missing thing that non-white people do not have collectively.
Failure to understand what racism, white supremacy is, how it works, for sure. VGQ, victims certainly guaranteed, qualified, you know, responding however they see fit. I will say with these shootings, though, the same thing. I had suspicion about Christopher Dorner. I try to use the language of suspected shooter Christopher Dorner. There was never a trial. He wasn't convicted of anything, so we didn't go over. There was not like a public review and an open hearing of all the evidence. But I also exercise a lot of suspicion in these instances. No one's even been apprehended in this shooting case, so all of this is, you know, still, as they say, ongoing. But, I mean, you just don't know the system of white supremacy. There's lots of deception, lots of things. Just there's a lot of deception in the system of racism, white supremacy, and generally with these shootings, even they're selective. We talked about that in 2016. You have shootings of police officers that happen more often than most people know. Not all of these shootings get the same attention. If a black person is accused of engaging in one of these shootings, Christopher Dorner, they'll make a movie of the year out of that sort of thing. That's primetime television right there. But white people engage in these shootings of enforcement officials more frequently, and they do not get nearly the same type of attention. You don't see President Trump and other white politicians or white speakers come out and this rhetoric of war on cops and all the rest of it. Fox News doesn't make that an endless loop of enforcement officials under attack. So I'm suspicious, particularly in an election year. I can't emphasize that enough because police shootings did become in 2016, and it looks like again this time around, a big part of President Trump's campaign. So I am suspicious in a system of racism. Race soldiers do engage in acts of white sacrifice. I'll stop there. Any other comments, suggestions, thoughts folks want to share before we conclude? Soon, folks, might be good. We'll be here Sunday afternoon, early time, Global Sunday Talk on Racism, 3 p.m. Eastern, 2 p.m. Central, 12 p.m. Pacific. We'll check in with folks, different parts of the globe, see, you know, what's happening with the Rona, what they've heard about the U.S. presidential elections and such. Dr. Ruby Lathan should be with us on Wednesday, back to normal time, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. As I said, we'll ask her about the Mexico situation, no junk food for children, and get more tips, suggestions on healthy eating. That'll be Wednesday, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. A listener notified me today. Isabel Wilkerson, victim of white supremacy. We are reading her book, Cased, The Origins of Our Discontent. So we're reading her book. We have done two sessions so far. We're still pretty early in the text. Third session will be this Thursday. A listener emailed me today. I was like, oh, man, Gus, it looks like Isabel Wilkerson was married to a white man. I looked. She has photographs on her verified Facebook page of she and her former white male husband, who looks like he might be considerably older than her. Like, I don't know his age, and I don't like, you know, guessing at that type of thing because I make errors. But, man, what's my man, white dog, Romaine Gary, where he had a woman who was a white woman who was like 20 years younger than he? Like, I'd be interested to find out how old Brett Hamilton, I believe, is his name. I'd be interested to find out how old he is and then how old she is, just to see if there's any sort of difference in age. But anyway, if anything, I can say the first response was more sadness, tragic arrangements, feverish, as Pam would say. The other response was more, I was a little surprised that we spent, because I mean, we spent months reading The Warmth of Other Suns back in 2013. And I'm surprised in all that time I was going and reading articles that she had, you know, written over the years and video content and interviews and lectures that she gave and all of that searching and looking that I and none of the other listeners who participated in that book club found that, oh, man, you know, she was married to a white person. Because I even remember seeing her in videos and interviews where she was asked, are you married? She was like, oh, no, I'm divorced now, blah, 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 and all that. But did not find that information out while we were reading back in 2013. Was reported today. I posted the photo online. I can only say in reading the book, she is a victim of white supremacy. But it does, in the book, there's a lot. I mean, she doesn't use the word racism. I can just stop right there. She doesn't use the word racism. In fact, in my view, it's not an exaggeration. She brags about not using the word racism. She talks in the very book we're reading about the word racism offending white people, and in fact, she often does not even use the word white people on the dominant cast. So, tragic arrangements. It does not take anything away. Her being a victim of white supremacy in a tragic arrangement does not detract from the enjoyment I derived and information gathered from The Warmth of Other Suns. However, I said in both books, and especially in Case, which is a very lame book, it's not accurate about racism, white supremacy. It's not describing this problem in an accurate manner at all, and her being a victim in a tragic arrangement or married to a white person. We will proceed, but that is Thursday, Case. Isabel Wilkerson, victim of racism. We are all still learning. Folks are satisfied, yes?
To add on to what you were just finished saying, it would probably be very difficult to have the code book, the word guide, and or the ISIS papers on a nightstand, and you are sexually involved with a white person at the same time.
Just a guess, you know. I'm not sure. Maybe it's possible. I think it might be a struggle. Pamela Evans Harris, the great, been on my mind. She said you can't lay down with white people and then get up and fight white supremacy. Or you can't fight lay down at night with a white person and then get up in the morning and fight white supremacy racism. It generally just does not work that way. And she talked about how she unfortunately had individuals in her own attempted family who were in tragic arrangements and what have you, and she said the exact same thing. She talked about how it adversely impacted their ability to even talk about racism, white supremacy. She said, and these are her family members. These are not strangers that she doesn't know, right? These are her family members, her relatives, where she's saying, because they're in these tragic arrangements, because they have these close, intimate relationships with suspected racists, it's now compromised their ability to even speak about this problem. Talk about racism avoidance disorder, RAD, as one of our investors termed it. It just really amplifies that. And I've said that over and over. That's why the acronym SAD, that is one of those letters, having divided loyalties and making space. That it's not all white people, and just not talking about this problem. I even said abstractions. That's what the A is for. She's got all those metaphors. I said abstractions, just as our caller said eloquently earlier, not making it exact and precise that white supremacy racism is what it means to be white, classified as white, being precise about that. It will be lots of abstractions and structural racism and embedded racism and all these other, you know, indirect ways of talking around the problem, circumloquacious. They have a word for that. But, yeah, we are all still learning as best we can and just trying to be as precise, accurate as possible in using words to describe the problem. I guess I'll give one quick answer quickly. A listener wrote in and asked about the value of reading books. I guess someone asked them what is the benefit or what's the constructive value of reading books. I can't just say that reading a book will end racism. I can't say that.
However, I do think that in the system of racism, white people conceal, hide a lot of information. If you are a curious person, there are many books that have lots of constructive information about lots of things, about eating correctly, racism, white supremacy, all kinds of subject matter. Once you can, you know, develop some curiosity and your skill with language, reading comprehension, wow, you can do a lot to combat deception and people who are dedicated to keeping black people, non-white people ignorant. You can do a lot to combat that by being able to read and acquire information for yourself. You will not be reliant on someone having to explain what progress is to you, to explain what racism is to you, to explain what healthy food is to you. You can go read the information for yourself, and lots of it. Even in the midst of the Rona with closed libraries, there's still lots and lots to read. So I think just having that curiosity, that eagerness, enjoyment of reading, and just looking for quality information to read, I think it will pay off. Not a matter, it will yield constructive results. And I guess I'll close it this way. There's lots you can check out. The people who do not do any reading, you can just check out. Like, are they knowledgeable? What are they knowledgeable about? And pay attention. The people that do a lot of reading, what they're reading about, what sort of knowledge and information do they have? People that don't do any reading that you're around, don't have any books, that's one thing that you can pay attention to. When you go to visit people's houses, check out. This person have books, yay or nay. It might be a little more challenging nowadays because a lot of people have e-books and such, but people still do have hardbacks. Check out, do they have books in the house? If not, what are their hobbies? What are they interested in? What's their vocabulary like? Not saying that any of those things are immediately going to solve the problem, but I have certainly concluded a major part of the problem. Talk about metaphors and all that. Words, the primary method of racism, white supremacy being maintained is white people's use of words, generally deceptively. Non-white people, us getting better with our skill with language, our use of words, all of that makes us better at disrupting someone who is intent on lying. The better you become at understanding words, you will be much better, at decoding deception. And I'll stop there. We'll pick up, or I guess tomorrow's thing, the Global Sunday Talk. We'll be here tomorrow. Much obliged to the folks who chimed in. Hope it was worthy of your Saturday evening. Sobriety would be best under conditions of white supremacy. That would be included in junk food, I think, in taking the best care of ourselves as we possibly can, trying to stay safe, healthy, to solve the problem. In addition to being sober, let's be buckled every time we are in a vehicle. Again, I would recommend let's be hunkered down. I think right now there are lots of dangerous white people. If you're in California, they got these shootings that is not resolved yet. At least, you know, as we went live on the program this Saturday, we're still unresolved. They hadn't had the shooter yet, so lots of reasons. The wildfire situation, the air is still really toxic all on the West Coast. Armed white people, the Rona. Lots and lots of reasons to be hunkered down. If you have to go out, I've said it again, be very alert. If it looks like any white people or any non-white people, if they're being hostile, loud, escalating, you want to be thinking this person could be armed. Time to go. No, this is not time to save face. This is not time to have any sort of a verbal confrontation with a stranger. Nope. Getting out of here. You can call the enforcement officials as you are exiting in your vehicle or whatever it is, but it is really not a good time to be risk takers given what we have seen thus far in 2020. If you have to go out, something serious, again, sober, buckled. If you are driving, you are not on the cell phone. Number one, we are trying to be attentive. Got to be alert to what's happening around us. For two, trying to minimize contact with race soldiers, badge or
no. All of that said, Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another black person. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice immediately. Cal signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim,
your
brother.
Problem. You're a victim.
I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my condition.
Mm-hmm.
Even my conditioning has been conditioned.